Hello.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to welcome board members, welcome guests, visitors, and staff that are here with us today. Today's meeting of the EQB will cover the items noted on the agenda. The agenda was covered in the members' board packet. Well, maybe we should do, you want to go through introductions first? What I'd like to do first is ask for a round of introductions. Because we have a rather busy schedule today, I'm not going to ask for any agency updates today. We will continue with that at our next meeting. John, would you like to start?
Sure. I'm John Saxhaug, and I'm a citizen member from the Twin Cities.
I'm Tom Landry. I'm the commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources.
Julie Gehring, citizen member from Moorhead.
Kate Knuth, citizen member from the Twin Cities.
I'm Leah Hedman. I represent the board as their legal counsel. I'm from the Attorney General's office.
My name is Brian Napstad. I'm the chairman of the Board of Water and Soil Resources. I'm the vice chair of the EQB, and since our chair is absent, I'm sitting in his stead today.
Will Seifert, executive director, Environmental Quality Board.
John Stein, commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency, and members, we have someone on the phone today, so be sure you're using your microphone whenever you speak. Folks on the line can hear us. Thanks.
I'm Eric Tomlinson. I'm a citizen member from the Twin Cities.
Kristen Ide-Tollefson, citizen member from Southeast Minnesota.
Thank you for that. And per Commissioner Stein's comment, Commissioner Rothman from the Commerce Department is joining us via teleconference. Mike, are you there?
I am. Thank you.
Can you hear us okay?
Perfectly.
Outstanding. Thanks. First item of business today is the adoption of the consent agenda. The packet that was mailed out to members contained the consent agenda, which is the proposed agenda for today's meeting and the November meeting minutes. Are there any adjustments to the minutes or the agenda as drafted? Seeing none, is there a motion to approve the consent agenda? Moved by Commissioner Stein, seconded by John. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Agenda and minutes are hereby approved. We've gone through introductions, and in terms of the chair's report, the only thing I will report is what I've said before. The chair is currently absent today. In fact, I believe he's out of the country. He'll be rejoining us for the next meeting, I'm sure. With that, I will move on to the executive director's report.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple brief scheduling notes. On January 12th, we're planning two events for the board. At 10 a.m., the Climate Change Subcommittee is convening a debrief session with the COP21 Paris attendees to talk about lessons from Paris and what they mean for Minnesota. And this will be held in the Discovery Hall Room. That's from 10:30 to 11. And then immediately following at noon, we'll begin our EQB work planning retreat. This will go until 4 p.m. and is in the Argonne Room of the Science Museum. Lunch will be available for participants. In addition to board members, tech reps are invited, as well as some staff who've participated in various EQB projects over the last year. We'll circulate the agenda beforehand, but on a high level, we really want to focus on board priorities for the upcoming year and going out further. Our January board meeting will include, and that's the following week, will include a presentation from the Interagency Climate Adaptation Team, as well as a presentation on pollinators. Please also note that the University of Minnesota Water Resources Center is hosting their annual Climate Adaptation Conference on January 28th at the Minneapolis DoubleTree. It was directed by the 2015 legislature, the EQB staff submitted a proposed rule change to the Office of Administrative Hearings on November 18th under the good cause exemption. The proposed rule relating to recreational trails was not approved by the ALJ. In her order, which is included in your packet, the ALJ raises questions about whether the legislative author's intent can be met using the good cause exemption. Staff is exploring some further language revisions to see if the rule can be resubmitted with the good cause exemption. Otherwise, we'll move forward with full rulemaking process, and we'll keep you updated on this matter as it progresses. Before we get into Courtney's presentation, I just want to take a minute to remind the board and those who are watching the context and background for this initiative and this conversation here today. Starting in August 2014, the Environmental Quality Board and the Department of Commerce have been leading an interagency effort to coordinate state resources and expertise on issues related to the projected increase in oil transport by way of pipelines across Minnesota. This effort began at the direction of agency leadership at a time when oil production of the West was increasing rapidly, and the state was trying to better understand the implications of this trend on Minnesota. There were citizen and legislative inquiries, and the agencies took it upon themselves to produce a comprehensive report on the various related issues that may confront policymakers in the future as oil pipeline projects are proposed and reviewed. 11 agencies have been participating in this effort, initially meeting on a weekly basis and now on a semi-regular basis, to share status updates, trends, and finalize the interagency report on oil pipelines. This effort has cascaded into greater interagency dialogue, both at the staff and leadership level, to coordinate on these complex topics. The report before you attempts to explore a multitude of issues, including but not limited to economics, taxes, environmental and human health concerns, emergency and spill response issues, and the approval process. The purpose of this report is twofold: to provide an informational resource for the general public to meaningfully engage in the process, and to provide information, findings, and considerations, and identify opportunities for further study to support policymaking going forward. This is not a comprehensive review of every relevant issue pertaining to oil transport by pipelines. Rather, it is a collection of facts provided by 11 agencies based on best available information and meant to inform and educate. The interagency team acknowledges this limitation in identifying areas for further study. It's very possible you walk away today with more questions than answers. These are complex issues. The report is neither an endorsement of nor an argument against moving oil via pipelines. It's an effort to explore the potential issues, both positive and negative, that result from oil pipelines to promote a broader understanding so that Minnesota's interests may be addressed as these infrastructure projects are proposed. It does not prescribe recommendations, but it does highlight areas for further consideration and study. It is important to note that the report is not a tool to adjudicate any specific or proposed pipeline, though many of the issues inevitably overlap. It's also important to note that more detailed study of issues pertaining to any specific proposal are considered in that project's permitting and environmental review process. The first draft of the report was presented to the EQB on March 18, 2015. A public comment period followed through the end of May. Comments were received and discussed by the interagency team. Some revisions were made to the report and is being delivered to you this afternoon as final. Courtney will go into more detail. Please note that the presentation from Courtney will not revisit the content in the report that was presented in whole last March, but will rather highlight some questions and identify comments received during the public comment process. Should you have questions about the underlying content, subject matter staff are available and in the room today. Following Courtney, Bill Grant will provide a more detailed presentation of the approval process and projects currently under review at the Public Utilities Commission. The board's mission is to coordinate across agencies on issues that are interdepartmental in nature and engage the public in environmental decision-making. We believe this effort has led to a high degree of interagency coordination, particularly across the agencies directly involved in the approval and review processes for pipelines, and has enabled a dialogue with the public and agency leadership on these issues, falling outside of traditional agency jurisdictions. While these issues will continue to be considered by policymakers and regulators alike, we are pleased that we were able to enhance the level of coordination and contribute a pretty comprehensive collection of facts to support this ongoing discussion. Before I turn it over, I just want to highlight some updates that were made to the report that may not appear in all of the printed copies. And for the board members, we have little tabs on the pages here, and they appear on page 2, 12, and 23. And so in those three places, you have updated numbers from 2014 to 2015. So the substance is really unchanged, but you have updated numbers there. So, and the most updated version is available on the web.
Okay, thank you, Will. Are there any questions by board members on the executive director's report or the introduction to the first presentation? Seeing none, before I turn it over to you, Courtney, I'd like to give our audience members just an idea of the order of business today. Courtney will be providing the interagency report on oil pipelines. I will follow that with board discussion, board questions, or comments regarding that report. We will then move into Bill's presentation on the pipeline project updates, followed again by board questions or comments. We will then go to audience member comments. Now, we do have comment cards. They're these purple cards. They're located on the front desk, a number of blanks. If you wish to comment or think you may wish to comment on either of the presentations, please fill out one of these forms and get them up to staff. I will call on them in the order that I've received them, and we would be happy to receive your comments regarding today's presentations. With that, if there is no further questions or comments by members of the board, I'll turn it over to you, Courtney.
Thank you, Chair
and board members. Again, my name is Courtney Ullers-Nelson. I am the Planning Director for Environmental Review at the EQB. And for the past year, I have been the project manager for the interagency report on oil pipelines. Sitting next to me, I would like to introduce Deputy Commissioner Bill Grant.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Bill.
Bill will be providing, again, some information on specific pipeline projects immediately following my presentation. So, again, for the last year, I have been the project manager working on the interagency report on oil pipelines. That has been, as you've heard, a collaboration amongst 11 separate agencies working on some very important information for the state. I'm here to talk about the report in its final version. In this presentation, I am going to touch base a little bit on the background. The executive director has provided you with some information, but I'm going to focus on the revisions to the report and more specifically the public comment that we received. We've organized the public comment according to the chapters or sections of the report. As you recall, in March of 2015, earlier this year, we talked about each chapter of the report, and there are four of them. Again, on economics, environment and human health, pipeline approval process or permitting, and spills and emergency response. So, as I said, the executive director did already provide some information on why this report was necessary, but oftentimes pictures are worth a thousand words. So this graph actually comes from the report, and it illustrates the production, the predicted production of Bakken oil. As you can see, that red line going across the screen represents the amount of oil being produced today, and that has been relatively the same since we started this project in 2014. That is a little over a million barrels per day. What you see directly above that on the blue lines, which are the projected low to mid and high levels of production. So anywhere from the current day's production of a little over a million barrels to 2.2 million barrels a day from the Bakken oil. In Minnesota, the green line below represents our current pipeline capacity and potential pipeline capacity if projects that we are aware of are approved. What this, again, is to illustrate is that there is a demand for moving oil, whether it be by pipelines or other means of transportation. So it is with that information that was initially provided to us in 2014 that we decided an interagency team should be formed to discuss the relevant issues associated with moving oil via pipelines. As you can see on the screen, the primary purpose was to bring together a collection of facts, shared information by these 11 agencies. We really wanted to first understand what do we know. From there, we are going to share this information with the public as well as policymakers going forward. As Will has mentioned, the EQB co-led this effort, as it is our role to bring to a head environmental issues that are interdepartmental in nature and to involve the public when possible. That leads me to my next slide, public comment. We had over 60 days of public comment on our report, and that was between March and May 1st of this year. The purpose was really to initiate public comment was so that we can open up the discussion wider and beyond state agencies. We heard from a number of stakeholders with a lot of interest and a lot of varied interest in that. So in doing so, you'll see that the final report is a collection of what state agencies know, as well as a set of important themes that the public has also identified for us going forward. It is important to note that the interagency team did not directly respond to every comment which we received. Rather, the public comments are summarized at the end of each chapter. So during our public comment period, as you can see on the slide, we heard from 23 groups and or individuals, and they represented the groups you also see identified on the screen, quite a variety of interest. Throughout the remainder of the presentation, I'm going to, again, highlight the comment themes and where we identified more study was needed as a result of those themes. So generally, the report as it is today, final, has not changed significantly or substantially from that original draft. Rather, we did some initial things like clarification, updating important numbers from 2014 to 2015, fixing footnotes, those sorts of things. We also brought together some really valuable information in which we heard not only during the public comment period, but also in front of this board in March. So some substantial changes are actually made to the background section. We heard from individuals that, you know, this stuff is really complicated. It's hard to understand why we're comparing rail and pipeline in some cases, or why we treat pipelines differently than railroads. That was a real issue that we heard quite a bit about. So we took the time to explain how the federal regulations for both of those industries developed over time. Mm-hmm. And again, why we treat those industries slightly different today. Each section and chapter was also slightly changed in that we made two additions. We made an addition to include a summary of the public comment. Again, these are important themes identified for the public comment, not public comment verbatim. And when more study was identified and needed by the team. I'm going to dive now into each chapter, but not too deep, because you all heard information in March. Rather, I'm going to give you a summary of some of the findings and considerations that each chapter brought forward. And then, as I said before, I'm going to highlight what the public said about those chapters and the important themes that they identified. As I do so, I'm going to be addressing whether we said these areas need future study or if they were just comments on the report. When it comes to economics, when we were in front of you in March, we made some conclusions. And some of those conclusions were that it seems we're going to need rail and pipeline to move oil in Minnesota. We also said that, of course, construction and the operation and maintenance of pipelines and rail are going to contribute to jobs in Minnesota, albeit slightly. Other important, businesses also... I'm pointing to the last bullet on the screen. Pipelines and railroads, much like any other business, contribute to taxes in Minnesota, but particularly in sales and property tax. These are some of the findings and considerations we brought forward. Now, here's what the public had to say. Before you are three important themes that were highlighted by the public. They said, ultimately, we really want to better understand the financial benefits and risks to local units of government. They also said that they had a general concern for economic impact of rail congestion. And we heard that in particular from ag groups across the state. And finally, we heard that they wanted a more robust comparison of the short-term and permanent jobs that these pipelines and railroads bring to the state. In the environment and human health section, we have findings and considerations that included things like when we're reviewing pipelines, we should also review health infrastructure and that be part of the review of a specific project. We also said that environmental justice considerations really are going to require greater outreach and on a more consistent basis. We identified that climate change is something that we need to discuss when we talk about moving oil across the state via pipelines. And finally, we said that the potential environmental impacts are there, both for terrestrial and aquatic habitats, and also to wildlife and water quality. So what did the public think about that? Well, the public said, you know, that's great. We have additional concerns. We have concerns regarding abandoned pipelines. Particularly, commenters were concerned about the environmental risk associated with the subsurface pipelines that could potentially impact groundwater, for example, or the chemical changes that are caused by the degradation of the pipe. Water contamination. This particularly gets to drinking water. Minnesotans are concerned with their drinking water and the potential contamination of groundwater or surface water resources. We also heard some comments on climate change. And the climate change comments ranged to quite an extent. We had some that said, this is not necessary not to be included in this report, while we heard others say, we need more. We need more information. Finally, folks said, we want to know and better understand the environmental implications of all modes of transportation of oil. That would include rail, truck, barge, etc. When it came to the pipeline's approval section, our third section or chapter in the report, we talked about things like the federal approvals that often preempt or take place before state approvals. We particularly identified that environmental analysis in certificate of need is a good thing, and that when it comes to the route permit, that generally comments and the ability for the public or state agencies to comment potentially during a draft period or a final draft would be valuable going forward. Overall, agency coordination is important during the pipeline approval process. We also said financial assurance mechanisms are something that the Public Utilities Commission may want to consider as they consider approving pipeline permits and various approvals. Landowner considerations were something that we discussed in the paper to some length, really around the idea of route fatigue. It is my understanding that when it comes to pipeline routing rules, the Public Utilities Commission must consider the use of existing right-of-ways. So that often means if a landowner has one pipeline crossing their property, they may have more in the future. As a result, we raised the question, should By the Farm be a statute that should be extended to landowners whose property is crossed by oil pipelines? Finally, again, we stressed early consultation with all affected parties, local units of government, and state agencies throughout the process. So, in summary of what the public had to say, that there were some common themes that you see on your screen, including a request for more public involvement, and they think everywhere, anywhere in the process. There was generally a request for greater recognition of tribal treaty rights and greater consultation with tribes. This is one area that the interagency team really said we need more discussion, we need more evaluation of the appropriate processes and policies going forward so we can improve our coordination. Folks also identified that there's just a general concern with the landowner rights. They agree with us. They have concerns over route fatigue. When it came to environmental review, again, we got a wide range of comments, some who asked for greater review and some who said that the potential for greater review could ultimately slow the process and the availability of cheap oil to this nation. When it came to our final chapter, here's what we said in our original draft, and which has not substantially changed by any means. We said that federal and state requirements for companies to respond to oil spills does not have enough specificity. That has gone unchanged. We also said that the federal agencies who oversee the federal required response have not done a good enough job in the past, and that comes from other federal reports. Finally, we said Minnesota agencies responsible for spill response plan review have gone underfunded in this area in the past. The public said, we don't know if we need this spill response comparison that was done. We had done a spill response comparison with railroads and pipelines in the report. They also said, we would really like additional information on the technology available to pipeline companies, particularly for their leak detection systems. So that's what we heard from the citizens who commented, the groups that commented. It's also a sense, it gives you a sense of what we discussed in the report, which has not changed substantially at this point. But one thing that we did identify are areas that need more study or discussion at the state level. Ultimately, you know, I think it's a good exercise sometimes to understand what you don't know or what you don't, the information you don't immediately have at your fingertips. And that was some of the discussion that came out. What do we need to know? What does Minnesota need to know going forward? And that's what those lists at the end of each chapter are for all of us. As Will pointed out, Executive Director pointed out, in some cases, we may just learn more as projects are being studied through the permitting and the environmental review process, and that is a good thing. In closing, I just want to reiterate what I said earlier, and that ultimately this information met its initial goal. This report is a compilation of all the facts that we have as a state right now. But as Will said, it doesn't mean that this is all the information that's out there. This is one contribution to understanding all the issues, all the externalities associated with moving crude oil by pipelines. Ultimately, we feel that the involvement of the public in this process also aligns with the EQB's mission to include and better inform and involve the public. Just to reiterate what the executive director said, we have made some additional tweaks to the information, particularly on the amount of oil being produced in 2015. And if you would like to see the most recent version of the pipeline report, I encourage you to go to our website where it is posted. So it is with that that I want to say thank you to all of the participants. I would be remiss, there have been many, if I did not say thank you to all the agencies that contributed. This was a large undertaking, 11 agencies, that's more than sit on this board. And to bring all those people together, I think, is something that requires some gratitude. And with that, I'm happy to take questions about my presentation of the final interagency report on oil pipelines.
Thank you, Courtney. Anybody have questions for Courtney, comments regarding the interagency pipeline support report?
Real quick, and I know we're not supposed to ask contextual questions, because it was flagged here, I just had a question on page 23. There's a reference to projections, and the I believe they're Canadian projections. And there are two different numbers per day by 2030. And I guess maybe just check on the text to clarify that. Only reason I noticed is because it was flagged here. Otherwise, I probably would have gone right past. But third paragraph. And maybe I'm understanding it incorrectly. The second sentence. Expected growth to 6.4 million barrels per day by 2030 is expected to slow to about 5.3 million barrels per day by the same year. Is 2030 a peak, or am I missing?
Board member, chair, I'm assuming I can address the board member. I'm going to talk to some folks and get back to you. I don't want to answer that right now. But as you can see in the report, we have a couple of graphs. And I encourage you to go to page 25 and 26. And there we show Bakken oil is the first graph and Canadian oil is the second. And in terms of 2030, that's just as far as our graphs go. Now, it might be an industry question as to how far do they usually make these sorts of predictions. And I'll consult with some of the staff that contributed and try to get an answer for you.
Okay.
This is brand new information that we wanted to include for this, but again, board member, I'll get some answers.
It's just a clarification suggestion before it goes final.
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Commissioner Langer.
You mentioned that the tribes provide some input. Could you explain a little bit more how you got tribal input onto this in this report?
Yes, thank you, board member. The tribal input came in a couple different ways. We had actual tribal council comments, sent us comments to the report. We also had nonprofit groups with tribal interests also respond to the comment period and send us critiques and comments as well.
Other questions? Courtney, I think I heard you reference this report as final. How would you anticipate this report being utilized from here forward?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ultimately, I see this as a resource for anyone going forward. We will do our best to keep it a living document. As I said, we just updated it with some important information from 2015. That sort of data is something that we found to be critical. I think it could be picked up and used by just about anyone. And as I said in my conclusions, you know, this is one contribution. So we believe it highlights what we know. We believe it highlights some things that we think may need to be thought about and looked into going forward, as well as where areas of future study are going to be needed. So I see it as being used in any which way, any way anyone feels comfortable using it.
And Mr. Chairman, just to add to that, you know, Courtney and Bill have presented the report in various policy forums and conferences and would anticipate doing so going forward. But also to note, while it is final, if there are grammatical or you know, minor revisions, it will make them and keep it updated in that regard.
Mm-hmm. Commissioner Stein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to commend the staff again. I know we did that back in early part of the year, but I really commend all the agency staff and the public who contributed to the report, because it shows that there, when there's a relevant issue, that the agencies can work cooperatively together quickly to produce a good and meaningful and useful document that can help illuminate the subject that is of interest. And I know often when the board deliberates on these questions of interagency cooperation, we have had some tension from time to time. But board members, I just wanted to make the point for all of us that it does add value when we all work together. And so it's a really good effort, and I commend you, Courtney, for herding the cats or keeping all the frogs in the wheelbarrow if Commissioner Fredrickson were here.
That's right.
So it's just a really significant effort, and thank you for all your hard work.
Great comment.
Go ahead. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Courtney, and it somewhat relates to what Eric asked, not in the specifics, but, you know, we've seen a pretty significant change in the price of oil and the amount that, I mean, I'm guessing a lot of the updates on numbers were projections on amount of oil produced or currently how amount of oil produced in the two, in the Bakken Plain and the Alberta oil sands. And so can you just comment on what those changes have been in terms of seeing those numbers and where maybe we could look to follow that more closely? Because I think in considering getting a certificate of need and whether or not these pipelines are in the interest of Minnesota, this idea of how much oil are we really going to have coming out of these formations and how much is that going to be going forward, I think those are really important questions. And I was just at the climate negotiations, and one of the big refrains heard there is that most of our oil and gas and coal reserves have to stay in the ground to meet the agreements that the world has agreed to with developing everything that's in. And we're seeing it now price-driven. You know, gas is $1.99. That impacts these formations because they're pretty – they're not traditional oil extraction. They're more expensive. And so I'm curious if you could just – getting to the point of the question, if you could give me some context about how those how a production has changed and how the projections of production have changed, and because it looks like you were trying to incorporate that into this final report.
Thank you, board member. Not significantly.
Okay.
That's the answer. In fact, we've seen, even though that the price per barrel has come down quite a bit, production has really remained at the same level as when we started this paper and when price per barrel was over $100. So that means that there's just better technology that's being utilized, particularly in the Bakken. And so they're able to extract with less with having to produce more wells, essentially. So their break-even point has been shown to come down significantly, as we're seeing now. And so the numbers did not change significantly. We're still showing that graph that I showed earlier, and that production will still continue as projected even a year ago when we released this. I am going to look to my left because the Deputy Commissioner may have more specific information to add.
No, and Mr. Chair, and Board Member Knuth, I really don't. We haven't updated the forecast that we relied on in preparing that graph. And I have been expecting to see some scaling back of production from the Bakken in particular. And so far, we haven't been able to pick that up in the numbers that we're looking at. But it certainly makes sense that would be an outcome, and the pipeline company has over time revised the level at which they have said they can break even or fall below that, and that number has come down, as Courtney suggested.
Can I have one pause? And just to follow up on that, because I think, and this is just to press a little bit more on the production, because it is, this drop in oil has been pretty quick and dramatic. Mm-hmm. And in the Bakken, my understanding from the report is that wells decline much more rapidly than in kind of more traditional oil mm-hmm. fields. And so we've still only in the last year or two been seeing this decline in price. And so how much do those with the decline, the faster decline in well production in the Bakken especially means you have to keep drilling a whole bunch to keep right. production levels up. Right. And so has there been indications that the drilling of new wells has increased at the same rate or has been leveling off? So it's sort of the preceding the production
right.
period. Yeah.
And Board Member Knuth, you're absolutely right. We have seen a fall off in the number of new wells being drilled. Mm-hmm. The existing wells, in order to remain profitable, as I understand it, need to continue pumping at maximum capacity. And they're new enough that they, for the most part, haven't reached their peak yet. Mm-hmm. You're right. All indications are that when they do, production from those wells will fall off quite rapidly. Mm-hmm. And if there aren't new wells to replace them, then we would expect to see an overall decline in the amount of production. One thing potentially mitigating against that, as you may have heard, Congress is once again considering lifting the oil export ban. And if that were to be the case, I would expect fields like the Bakken to be back in the money. Mm-hmm. And
that answer your question?
Mm-hmm.
Other questions? If not, before we move on to Bill's presentation, I'd like to make one last call. We have these comment cards. They're available up at the front desk here. If you feel that you would like to comment on either Courtney's presentation she just provided or Bill's, which you're about to hear, please fill one of these out and get it up to staff, and I will call mm-hmm. on the speakers in the order that we've received. Bill, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and board members. What I'd like to do today is, first of all, give you a broad overview of the regulatory process at the state level for crude oil pipelines, and then to report specifically on the status of those regulatory proceedings with respect to two projects, the Sandpiper Pipeline, which, as you know, is proposed to move oil from the Bakken through Minnesota to Superior, Wisconsin, and then on the Line 3 replacement project, that's replacing an existing oil pipeline that is carrying Canadian crude oil from Alberta. So moving to the first slide, maybe.
I'm trying to load that. Assistance.
Lost mouse power.
Yeah. Apologize for the technical juggling.
The third one down.
Thank you.
I know.
Thank you.
I tried to joke out. Went down in flames.
My joke.
Put it down.
Is this one going to work? And which is the...
Push the left to advance.
Very good. So, to begin at a high level, the pipeline approval process at the state level requires two approvals, both from the Public Utilities Commission. The first is a certificate of need. This is for all petroleum pipelines greater than 6 inches in diameter and covering more than 10 miles of length in Minnesota. So that would cover both the Sandpiper and Line 3 replacement projects. You can see the statutory and Minnesota rule sites there for that process. And then a route permit also from the Public Utilities Commission for projects roughly of the same dimensions. First question that gets asked is that, is there a need for a project of this size and type at this time? The need analysis is conducted by the Department of Commerce, Division of Energy Resources. It includes an environmental analysis by the department, and public hearings are conducted leading up to a decision by the Public Utilities Commission. There are multiple opportunities for comment, public comment, and participation in public hearings, public information meetings, and so forth. This is a schematic of the approval process, beginning with application acceptance, a review of the facts and merits of the case. I mentioned the public hearings. Then there are evidentiary hearings in front of an administrative law judge. This is a trial-type proceeding where witnesses, both for and opposed to the project, stand for cross-examination by other parties. Then we have an administrative law judge report to the PUC, and there's an opportunity for public comment and a public meeting opportunity at that juncture. And then the matter goes before the commission for a final decision on certificate of need. Approximate time from date of application acceptance to final action by the commission, somewhere between 12 and 15 months. Some of the factors that the commission is required under their rules to consider. First is the future adequacy, reliability, or efficiency of energy supply. And this is important to the applicant, to the applicant's customers, or to the people of Minnesota and neighboring states, a rather broad sense of determining need. Second, that a more reasonable and prudent alternative to the project hasn't been demonstrated, and this is a case where the burden of proof is on the applicant. The consequences of granting the certificate of need are more favorable than the consequences of denying the certificate. And finally, that the project as proposed is in compliance with all local, state, and federal regulations. And the PUC needs to be able to, from the record that's in front of it, make affirmative conclusions with respect to all of these factors when making an ultimate finding of need. Second question then, assuming that the commission determines that there is a need for the project, is where, if needed, should the pipeline be located, and just how should it be constructed? And in this case, the environmental review component of the permitting process is conducted by Commerce, but a different unit within Commerce, our Energy Environmental Review and Analysis team. Alternative routes, to the extent that they're proposed, are approved for study by the PUC. Typically and historically, these projects have gone through what is known as comparative environmental analysis, which is an alternative form of MEPA review incorporated into the permitting process. So this is something that has been a feature of pipeline review for a number of years, has also been tested through the courts to determine whether, in fact, it does meet MEPA standards. There is a public hearing and multiple opportunities for public input during the route permit proceeding. And just again, a schematic of the process from beginning to end including once the application is accepted, consideration of alternate routes and an environmental analysis of those alternate routes. Those are all then taken to public hearings. Again, to evidentiary, there is another trial-type proceeding, just as there is in the Need case. An administrative law judge hears that and provides a report to the PUC prior to making a route decision. And again, approximately the same length of time, about 12 to 15 months from beginning to end. Typically, these processes have run concurrently, but as we'll discuss in a few minutes, the commission decided to take a different path with respect to the Sandpiper pipeline. And the factors that are then considered in the route selection process, human settlement, including displacement, noise, aesthetics, cultural values, recreational amenities, and public services, the natural environment, and that's a very broad look at all potential natural environmental impacts, archaeological and historic resources to the extent that those are present along the route, the economic impacts to various industries within the state, the cost of the pipeline and its accessibility, and by that we mean the ability to get to it for proper maintenance and in the event of a spill addressing that spill immediately. Use of existing rights of way, there's always a preference where possible to use already approved rights of way rather than greenfield rights of way. The cumulative effects of future pipeline construction, to the extent that we know that there will be other pipelines likely proposed along the same route, what would be the cumulative impact of that? And again, compliance with all applicable regulations. Turning then to the Sandpiper pipeline project specifically, this is a project proposed by the North Dakota Pipeline Company. They are a wholly owned subsidiary of Enbridge. It proposes to transport crude from the Bracken to Clearbrook and then Clearbrook, Minnesota, and then on to Superior, Wisconsin. It includes new terminal facilities near Clearbrook with two storage tanks holding over 6 million gallons each, 75 miles of 24-inch pipe between the North Dakota border where it crosses into Minnesota and Clearbrook with an average annual capacity of 225,000 barrels a day, and then 224 miles from Clearbrook to Superior with an average annual capacity of 375,000 barrels per day. Both the certificate of need and route applications for this project were accepted by the PUC in February of 2014, which initiated the review process. The Line 3 replacement project, this is a line owned by Enbridge Energy. It is designed to replace an existing 282 miles of 34-inch pipeline with 337 miles of 36-inch diameter, so increasing a slight increase to the diameter of the pipeline. This pipeline was originally placed in service in 1968. Integrity issues have led to pressure and capacity reductions, meaning that as the pipeline has gotten older, the company has had to scale back the volume going through and the pressure within the line to prevent leaks or spills from occurring. The project is designed to restore the line to its historical operating capacity of near 760,000 barrels per day. And Enbridge's preferred route is adjacent to the Sandpiper line from Clearbrook to Superior. And these route CN and route applications were accepted in August of 2015. This is a map of the two lines, and just to help you, because it isn't meant to be an eye test, the Line 3 route is in red, the line three, that's the current line three pipeline. The line three applicant preferred route is in solid blue. The Sandpiper accepted route alternative is in purple, and the Sandpiper, so that would be alternatives that have been approved for consideration as part of the routing process are in purple, and the Sandpiper preferred, the Enbridge preferred route is in gray, which you can see overlaps the line, the Sandpiper, or the line three route from Clearbrook to Superior. This gives you some sense of the timeline and next steps we expect with both the Sandpiper and line three projects. At this point, we're here in December of this year, and tomorrow the Public Utilities Commission will consider various procedural steps that need to be decided before moving ahead with review of both projects. There was an issue raised about the original approval of the certificate of need for the Sandpiper line. And if I go back to the, how do I go back?
That's a great question. Here, let me go back for you.
As you can see, the PUC did grant a certificate of need for the Sandpiper project in August of this year. That decision was taken to the State Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals, the issue there was whether MEPA required completion of an EIS before the PUC could make a final decision on the certificate of need for a large oil pipeline. Remind you again that typically, at least historically, those two processes, the certificate of need and the routing process, have run concurrently, which means that there was always a MEPA-compliant document available for the Commission's consideration before they acted on the certificate of need, and then usually at the same meeting subsequently on the route permit. Is it on here? I'm not sure that it is. At some point along the way, the PUC decided to bifurcate the two processes under the argument that why would we go through a routing process before determining whether the project was needed or not? And so let's run them sequentially rather than concurrently. And as a result of that, and the fact that a certificate of need at that point had not, the process had not produced a MEPA-compliant document, the court found that the commission took an action that it should not have because it was a major environmental action under Minnesota statute, which would require a MEPA-compliant document. So the decision was that the commission erred in approving the certificate of need without the MEPA-compliant document. In this case, the court found that an EIS was the preferred form of MEPA compliance. Just yesterday, this action was appealed to the state Supreme Court by both the Public Utilities Commission and Enbridge. And just yesterday, the state Supreme Court declined to review that decision. So that decision stands, and it's, I think, helpful that we got that decision before the commission takes more procedural steps tomorrow. So at the hearing tomorrow, the issues include what procedures should be used for both Sandpiper and Line 3 both on the certificate of need and the route permit, whether the processes and hearings should be separate, joint, or sequential, whether the two projects, again, since the preferred route overlaps, whether or not the environmental review should be separate or together to account for the cumulative effects of both projects in the same corridor, and should the commission direct the department to perform a comparative environmental analysis or an EIS. Commerce, in a letter that you have distributed to you, has recommended an EIS for the Sandpiper route. I believe that a number of other parties, including Enbridge, have endorsed that approach. The letter that's in front of you also suggests that the department is going to enter into an interagency agreement with the Pollution Control Agency and the Department of Natural Resources so that we can take advantage of their expertise in conducting the formal environmental review, whether that's CEA or EIS. Finally, the department has, per an order that was still standing from the commission from August, has prepared a draft scope for the environmental review of the cumulative impacts of the Sandpiper and Line 3 projects, including the right-of-way needed for a co-location of the lines between Clearbrook and Superior, the preferred route, and all the alternative routes that have been accepted so far by the Public Utilities Commission. It's not to say that the PUC may not add additional routes for consideration at their meeting tomorrow or subsequent to that. We're going to look at the impacts from construction and operation, including the impact of spills if they were to occur. We have developed a very extensive study process looking at spills, both of Bakken oil from a Sandpiper line and the heavier crude flowing on the Line 3 project. We will look at associated facilities, including pumping stations, valves, access roads, high voltage transmission lines, and substations that are needed to service the pumping stations. So all of those things will be considered. The cumulative effects of past, present, and reasonably foreseeable future actions, and any alternatives to the project, including the no-build alternative and other alternatives for transportation, such as rail and truck. So with that, Mr. Chairman and members, I'm happy to take any questions that you might have.
Questions for Bill?
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Jim.
Thank you. Thanks, Mr. Chair. Bill, just a few things from your slides that I wanted to just get clarification on for the sake of informing all the dialogue. On slide four, you laid out the process of the commission opening and accepting applications. And I just wanted to contrast what a PUC process is, what that means. It's different than a permit proceeding in many other environments. It's a little bit more formal and rigorous in terms of representation. I wondered if you could just talk about how people participate in being represented in processes that go before the commission.
Certainly. Mr. Chairman and Board Member Stein, there are really two forms of participation in proceedings before the commission. There's formal party status, and those parties participate not only in public meetings, perhaps, but also in the formal evidentiary proceedings that occur before the administrative law judge. More often than not, those parties are represented by counsel and present expert witnesses during that part of the proceeding, and those experts stand for cross-examination, as I mentioned earlier. So those really are the and then there's the general public, which of course do participate in all or are free to participate in all of the public meetings, public hearings, and whose comments during those are heard also by an administrative law judge who summarizes the comments that have been received so that the commission can consider those in its decision as well.
So the commission kind of parses the both the public participants as well as the evidentiary participants, but they are merged together in the deliberations of the commission. Is that fair to say that?
Chairman, absolutely, yes, that is.
Thank you. But it's different than many other proceedings in regards to the sort of quasi-judicial feel of the experience. I don't know if I'm mischaracterizing that or not.
Well, Mr. Chairman, all of the decisions that come before the PUC are done in a quasi-judicial fashion. In other words, they act as judges. They are to base their decisions entirely on the record that's in front of them. Ex parte communications are prohibited so that individuals or parties can't lobby them individually or collectively on behalf of their project, except through the formal proceedings that are laid out in these processes.
And I guess, Mr. Chair, if I could just, I have a list, so I'll try to be brief, but I think it's important for the purpose for which the commission functions, which is under the statute, that's their job. It's not that they've elected to have a different kind of a process. And maybe you could just go back a little bit and speak to the purpose of the statute. What is the purpose of the commission in regards to pipeline routing and pipeline need determinations?
Mr. Chairman and Board Member Stein, commission's purpose, as it is with respect to all large energy facilities that get proposed for construction and operation in Minnesota, are required by statute to consider both the need for those projects and the environmental and other impacts associated with them in siting or routing those facilities. So this is not unlike high voltage transmission lines, large power plants, other facilities associated with delivering energy services to consumers within the state of Minnesota, or in this case, projects that simply pass through the state of Minnesota on their way somewhere else.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On slide 5, you talked about the demonstration of a prudent alternative hasn't. And so could you, when the commission makes its determination of need and there's a deliberation over prudent alternatives, the project proponent puts forward a preferred alternative, I would assume. And then I was curious how prudent alternatives become presented to the commission.
Mr. Chair and Board Member Stein, in the case of the certificate of need process, the commission is considering issues of size, type, and timing. In other words, do we need a project of this size? Do we need a project like this? Is it a pipeline? Is it a rail? Is it some alternative to it? Or is it is this when we need it, or could we defer the need through some other means? Conservation, perhaps, could be a reasonably prudent alternative.
Thank you. You talked about in both slides 6 and 15 the difference, some of the variations between a comparative environmental analysis as an alternative form of MEPA compliant review versus an EIS. And I thought I just wanted you to reiterate that. I think in slides 15 you said that there would be the no action alternative considered. And my understanding under the comparative environmental analysis is that there was not a no action alternative that was before the commission. Or if I'm mistaken on that, I just wanted to clarify the difference. So it's because I think this may come up in commentary from the citizens, I just wanted to be sure I understood if there was a presentation of a no action alternative during the comparative environmental analysis.
Let me get you an answer to that question.
Thank you. And lastly, Deb's here.
Good afternoon. Deborah Pyle with the Department of Commerce. I believe your question was with regard to the items we had listed in the scope. This is the draft scope as we, as Commerce, have proposed it. And you are correct that usually in a routing environmental review process, we do not look at a no build. We have, however, in this particular situation, recommended that it be included.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Deb. And then my last question, Mr. Chair, was on tribal consultation. You talked about public participation, and I think there was some reference, or maybe I'm blending the conversations here, but can you just remind me what the commission and the department do with respect to tribal consultation throughout this process?
Mr. Chair and Commissioner Stein, because the Public Utilities Commission is a quasi-judicial body, they don't consult with parties separately during the course of considering a project approval. This is to preserve the integrity of the process itself. The governor's executive order directing state agencies to prepare consultation policies with tribal governments, while it did not list the Department of Commerce, we have assumed that it should apply to us, and we have begun to develop a policy, and we have had our first consultation with the Mille Lacs Band just a week or so ago.
Thank you. That's all, Mr. Chair.
Okay. On my list. Before I ask for further board input or questions, I would like to find out if Commissioner Rothman is still on speakerphone. Commissioner Rothman? I wanted to do that because you're essentially dealing with the Department of Commerce, and I thought maybe Mike would have some input.
I can ask staff to call. I'll go back in the
okay. I believe we had a question to Commissioner Landwehr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Bill, John asked many questions that answered some of mine, but the question I still have in my mind is, it sounds like the commission will decide tomorrow what the next step is, and one of those is recommended by the PUC, by the Commerce, is to undertake an EIS. If they go that route, will that be the full sort of statutory EIS process? And then is that slide 15, that's your draft scope, is there still an opportunity for public comment in the initial scoping process?
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner Landwehr, since I can't forecast with perfect foresight what the commission is going to do tomorrow, I'll just speculate a little bit that if they do endorse an environmental impact statement and that be done pursuant to that portion of statute, that we will restart the process, open the scoping process up as that process requires.
And just a follow-up observation, then obviously the draft scope could be changed dramatically by virtue of public comment.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Landwehr, it certainly could, yes.
Commissioner Ellinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Bill, this is an area where I don't know a whole lot about how the process, but I know that in previous projects when thought of a health impact assessment was brought up, the thought was that earlier on in the process before an EIS would be done would be a great time to do a health impact assessment, which really could get a lot of community input about the broad impacts of health. Has a health impact assessment been considered early on in the process before the EIS gets fully scoped out so that you get that kind of community input? It relates to some of the other questions that have come up about the consultation that's going on.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner Ellinger, no, not specifically. Certainly, that's not something that the commission has done historically. It may be a good idea to make the commission aware of that possibility and what would be entailed in such a review, and there may be a willingness to consider that as well.
Thank you.
Kristen, did you have a comment?
I had a quick question for Mr. Grant regarding the different environmental issues that are relevant to the two proceedings, the certificate of need and the routing and siting. Could you expand upon that a little bit?
Mr. Chair and Board Member Heidi Tollefson, again, as I mentioned before, in the certificate of need phase, we're looking at issues of size, type, and timing. So really rather high level impacts from a prospective project. Whereas in the routing phase, we're looking very granularly at the impacts of the project in the place that the project is physically going to go. So that would expand the list of things to consider to things like the construction impacts, the impacts to local traffic. All of those kinds of things would be considered in the routing phase that are in addition to what would typically be considered at the need phase.
Could you give an example of high level?
Well, I think there are a number of things. When we looked at, for example, comparing some of the route alternatives, the not fine-grained route alternatives, but routes that would have been separated by, in some cases, hundreds of miles, we looked at things like how much prime farmland was crossed, how much forested land was crossed, how many streams and rivers were crossed, how much population was impacted within a certain number of miles of the route. So those are the more high-level things that would be considered at that phase.
Okay, and I had one more question about the certificate of need. It's my understanding that in the it's the certificate of need as a permit that conveys the right of eminent domain to a project. Is that true in oil pipelines as it is in some other proceedings?
Actually, and I'll confirm this, but I believe Board Member Heidi Tollefson that it's the route permit that conveys the eminent domain authority. But you need to have both. You can't start construction on a project without both the certificate of need and the route permit. Once you have both, you're also then conveyed eminent domain authority.
And you'll clarify that if there's any. Okay, thanks. Thank you.
Maybe Courtney can do that.
Did you want to clarify that?
I have additional information to answer Board Member Tomlinson's question, I believe, but I don't want to interrupt the questioning.
Well, I think if we want to answer that question first, if we have more info, that would be.
You can go ahead and provide that information, Courtney.
Okay. Board Member Tomlinson, you had a question about Canadian production and our update in the amounts that we believe have been recently forecasted. That's on page 23. I just wanted to, now that I have some clarity in the document in front of me, I think I can respond. But that 3.8 million barrels is what's being produced today. That is consistent with the graph in the document. Of course, we previously in our 2014, when we first started this, in the first edition, we had said that the expected growth would be up to 6.4 million. Million barrels per day by 2030. Again, our graph kind of represents that. But we have also heard in 2015, with recent data from the North Dakota Pipeline Authority, which publishes a monthly update on these forecasts, that production will slow by 2030 to about 5.3 million barrels per day. Does that offer greater clarity, or do you have an additional question?
So just so I understand, this is 6.4 million barrels per day. That's
what we said before.
Replaced by 5.3 billion.
Yes, it's been reduced to
5.3. Okay. And if I said billion, I apologize.
That's okay.
Okay.
Okay, Kate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is for Mr. Grant. First, I couldn't see the timeline, so I was squinting, but I couldn't quite get it. So just to be clear, I want to make sure I have the right understanding because it'll impact my subsequent questions. So right now, basically, the commission is meeting tomorrow and will decide procedural steps tomorrow. And basically what you were kind of surmising, and you don't predict the commission, right, but was that they would open this EIS again, or they would open the EIS and they would do scoping again, and then that goes. So that would be the 12 to 15 month sort of estimate that you gave, and then post that another 12 to 15 months of certificate of need. Is that, could you just clarify that
Certainly.
A little bit?
Thank you, and sorry if there was confusion on that point. One of the issues that the commission will consider is whether to rejoin the proceedings or not, so that they would then, going forward from this point, run concurrently. So that is one of the decision alternatives that's okay. in front of them.
And that?
In which case, the expectation is that we would accomplish both in that 12 to 15-month time frame.
And that works with I'm assuming that works with the Supreme Court the Court of Appeals decision, but they'll have to decide.
They will. They'll need to make that interpretation. As I read the court's opinion, as long as there is a MEPA compliant document available before they make the certificate of need decision, okay. they will be on safe ground.
Okay. So I'm trying to understand in here, you've talked about the certificate of need, size, type, and timing of this. And you've talked about routing, which you said you get into more granular crossing waterways and sensitive areas and mm-hmm. place, you know, various parts of land. What I'm trying to understand is in the decision, you have the no build alternative or the no action alternative, however you want to describe it. Which would have impacts on transportation of transport of oil. But what I'm trying to understand is where would the consideration of the sort of the broader consequences of increasing fossil fuel infrastructure and impacts on climate change. So is that part of the certificate of need? Is it part of the environmental impact statement? Is it both? If you could describe that for me.
Mr. Chairman and Board Member Knuth, I think that all depends on what scope the commission ends up adopting for consideration during the environmental review process. And certainly it's conceivable, even though the types of impacts you're suggesting are not explicitly mentioned in the statute or the rules now, that they could be included for consideration as part of this review process.
Okay. Another question, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking on page 62 of the report with the criteria used by the commission and evaluated by Commerce, Department of Energy Resources. I'm assuming that's what DER is a yeah. for a pipeline certificate of need. And they have to evaluate these various things, and then they have to consider, they have to assess these 4 points. And one is the consequences to society of granting the certificate of need are more favorable than the consequences of denial. It seems to me that climate change could potentially go in there, but it's not obvious. And I'm interested also in the, so one, has climate change ever been considered in a certificate of need under that criteria? Just from your, you've watched the PUC for a while. And then the first one, the probable result of denial would adversely affect the future adequacy, reliability, or efficiency of energy supply to the applicant, their customers, or the people of Minnesota and neighboring states. And this one I'm curious about because, excuse me, I've some allergies because it hasn't frozen out there yet. I'm curious, on that one, because these pipelines go through the state, and you commented about, I mean, there's a lot of ifs here, right? We're in a very uncertain time with fossil fuel infrastructure. You commented about the potential oil export ban going up. And in a way, you could, I think, make a logical argument that putting this pipeline in makes oil go out of Minnesota more easily, maybe. I don't know. I think you could potentially make that argument. So I'm curious about how big of a scope, if you could talk a little bit more about how big of a scope they're considering in that first criteria with Minnesota and neighboring states and then oil moving through the state that may not be used here. So I guess two questions. One is the third criteria and considering climate change in there and if that has been done before by the PUC. And then the first criteria, because these pipelines are crossing the state, how the commission has considered Minnesota-specific consequences versus the broader sort of energy market consequences.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and Board Member Knuth, understand that these are the criteria related specifically to crude oil pipelines, not to certificates of need generally. And since it has been some time since the commission has been asked to consider a new pipeline proposal, and really before concerns about climate change have become as prominent as they are now, I don't believe that it has been considered in this context under a certificate of need review. Certainly, as we consider electrical energy decisions today, climate change considerations are very prominent in the certificate of need review, and how to include them in the case of a pipeline, particularly one that isn't going to be serving the state is directly with oil, is a more challenging question, and one that I don't think that the commission has really given full consideration to at this point.
Before we take any more questions, is Mike Rothman back on the line? I thought I heard a beep.
Yeah. He was hanging up on you. No, I'm kidding.
Okay. Question maybe for both Courtney and Bill. Courtney, in your report that on page 25, you indicate that known projects are going to have three incremental increases in oil transport capacity. Bill, you've outlined two projects. Is there a third out there that we're aware of that?
Chair and board members, it's my understanding that the third is a phase two upgrade to the Sandpiper line.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay.
Something that would add capacity and volume to that project, subsequent to development of the project that's been proposed, but it would not involve the construction of a new pipeline, but it may involve the addition of additional pumping facilities, for example.
Thank you, Eric.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a couple questions. One pretty specific, and then another more generalized. A citizen actually emailed a comment and a concern about the draft scoping document and for the environmental review. Mm-hmm. And it is relatively specific, and I don't know if you have an answer for it, but a couple of the data sources cited in attachment 1A are listed here as data restricted source. It is for drinking water sources and unusually sensitive ecological areas. It's what it states in the table, but then it goes on in the text. I guess I'm just curious what that means, if you know, or if there's someone here who knows.
I don't. We can bring Ms. Pyle back up. I believe she could probably answer that question.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I might be able to offer some insight on the second one, Eric, the data-restricted sources on particularly sensitive things. We have a database of, for instance, very rare species. We don't make it public as to where specific locations are, but for the purposes of environmental review, we compare the proposals against those known locations. We know that there are some people who go out and collect those things if they knew where they were, so we make very general information available, for instance, which township or which section it might be in, but not very specific information that might be used in a routing discussion.
Thank you.
Did that answer? Deb, did you have something to add?
Thank you. Yes, that pretty well deals with the issues, and I think the ones you're particularly referring to are some data sets that are federal data sets, but it's the same sort of situation where we're able to acquire and use them in environmental review but have to present them in a way that doesn't reveal some of the specifics.
Thank you.
Did you have something else, Eric?
I did. I guess regarding the environmental review, and I understand the PUC meets tomorrow and a decision will be made. If you know, we're talking about an EIS versus a Commerce internal environmental review, is that the alternative?
Mr. Chair and Board Member Tomlinson, I wouldn't consider it a department internal review. It has public involvement incorporated into it as well.
Okay. I apologize. I didn't.
No, I didn't take offense.
It stays within Commerce, though. Is I guess maybe this maybe I should back up. When a siting goes under environmental review under these Minnesota rules, energy projects, is there? You know, I think about an environmental impact statement. In maybe our arena, the agencies are working together, mm-hmm. and I just want to try to better understand.
Oh, I see.
The agency involvement with Commerce in that review sure. process.
Mr. Chair and Board Member Tomlinson, first of all, in these kinds of cases, the Public Utilities Commission is considered the RGU, and they delegate environmental review responsibilities to the Department of Commerce. We very commonly work with other agencies in the preparation then of those environmental review documents. And that has been the case throughout this process to date. And as I mentioned earlier, we intend to formalize that with two agencies, the PCA and DNR, through an interagency agreement.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to clarify understanding.
Mm-hmm.
At this point in time, if it pleases the board, what I'd like to do is move on to public comment. We have a number of people that have traveled a long ways to address the board, and I'd like to respect that fact. We have a number of cards up here. This meeting is set to adjourn at 4 o'clock sharp, and that's how long our video telecast works for. So we want to make sure that your comments are caught on tape live for those individuals that are visiting through teleconference. So what I'd like to do is ask, try to contain your comments to approximately a 5-minute period. That way we can ensure that everybody will have the ability to address the board and address all those interested parties that are out in cyberspace. So with that, as I indicated, I would just call them in random order or the order that I was given them. The first individual I would like to call up to testify before the board is Willis Madison of Osage, Minnesota. Willis will be representing himself according to the card. And for the purposes of the record, I would ask that everybody I call up please introduce themselves for the record.
Thank you, Mr. It's on?
When the light is off, it's on.
Okay. There we go.
Very intuitive, right?
I guess. I used to run sound systems. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. My name is Willis Matson. I am an ecologist by training, and I had a career with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, retired in 2001, and have frequently been called upon and volunteered to work with citizen groups to better enable them to participate and understand the process that's going through when projects are going to affect their lives and their future. And I was drafted into doing this, and I'm doing it willingly, but it's been an excruciatingly difficult experience. I've spent about a year and a half at it now. I thought it would be about 6 months. I want to present to you what I believe would be the citizen's view, not only through my eyes, but the people who I have worked with over time.
And I'm going to ask you to grant me just a little extra time. I'm sorry you called me first. I was going to actually ask that you call me last. If I go over a time limit of some sort, I apologize. Maybe I'd finish later.
Can you give us an idea of the amount of time you're looking for?
I'm probably going to need about 9 minutes by my practice going through this.
Okay, go ahead.
So, and I'm already off and running by not knowing how to run the clicker.
Courtney will help you.
Yeah, you should be able to just click the left.
Oh, we clicked. Oh, no wonder. Technology, please don't count this time against
there
me.
There you go. There you go. It's
left.
There you go.
All right. Yeah, we all recognize that everything has changed in the last 10 years, where oil used to be imported from other countries. It's now coming from Alberta and the Bakken oil. So we're changing the direction of the oil being shipped. And we have to realize where the oil comes from and where it's going, and in order to understand the need as the citizens see it. And Minnesota has reduced its dependency on petroleum, so we are largely a pass-through state. So we're doing this favor to the rest of the nation at the risk of our resources. So we're especially careful on how we think that should be done. We do this because back in the day when the first pipelines were put in, environmental rules were not in place. Pipeline companies put them in straight lines between the two points they wanted to get to and ran across country. We've had some spills in horribly difficult locations, and we don't need to repeat those kinds of mistakes. But Sandpiper routing had been isolated on a state-by-state basis and become something of a domino process. When North Dakota does their part, they bring it to our border, and we have to start from that point and deliver it to Wisconsin border, and then Wisconsin has to start from there. There's something fundamentally wrong when we do that in a connect-a-dot basis. The scope of this project is actually enormous. The geographic scale is continental. Its impacts are global. It dwarfs copper-nickel in terms of the total footprint, acres, streams impacted, watershed streams, and everything else you can think of to compare it to. The number of states, counties, townships, tribal territories, and reservations it impacts. And then by far the largest hazardous material storage and shipment facility in the state, and without secondary containment. Your local gas station over here has greater safety, secondary safety standards on it than this pipeline and the tanks that store the oil in it. So it is particularly hazardous. And it has serious international implications. And when I say international, that does not mean we leave out tribals, because they are, in fact, other nations. And yet, Minnesota has never prepared a first-class EIS on an oil pipeline. We have yet to coordinate a review with the neighboring states. Minnesota has never considered an alternate vendor. Enbridge is the only show in town. It's as though if they don't build it, nobody will. That's not true. Federal agencies that can perform review on an interstate basis have not even been brought into the picture, and agencies have not had meaningful consultations with tribes. We find ourselves stuck in something of a paradigm. And the result is that we have lost our objectivity when it comes to considering alternatives. For example, are there any alternative vendors that can ship oil from the Bakken to the Midwest and to export on the coast? Sure there are. Enterprise Product Partners and Energy Transfer Partners have both proposed pipelines. One of them has dropped out because another company has basically signed up contracts for the oil. But these companies are proposing to ship oil by more direct routes from the Bakken and Alberta down to the center of the country where the hubs and refineries are. In our environmental review, we don't consider them. The current paradigm is to play the in order to play the alternative game, we're forced to connect the dots. The company says that we have to start at the North Dakota border south of Grand Forks. We must pass through Clearbrook, and we must end up in Superior. And this is to ship oil from the Bakken to the middle of the United States and to export on the coasts. How does Minnesota get in the way? I'm not sure about that. Only because Enbridge has infrastructure here already is the only answer I can come up with. But what if we played the same game and connect the dots between the Bakken and those points where the oil is actually going? To the Midwest, Then it becomes a different game, yet our review does not allow that. And why are citizen-proposed system alternatives summarily dismissed in the process? Friends of the Headwaters, one of the groups that I work with, and Richard Smith will speak here a little bit later, has proposed a number of alternative routes that do still pass through Minnesota, but do avoid the sensitive, high-quality lake regions of the state. And I'm sure Mr. Smith will point out why some of these are particularly advantageous to the country, too. But they are more direct line between where the oil comes from and where it's going. It does not have to go to Clearbrook and through Superior to get there. The reason that they have not been included, and these routes have all, by the way, that I showed you there, have all been rejected and not being considered further, is because the PUC and Department of Commerce paradigm. That these routes are deemed different projects rather than project alternatives. And by simply naming them different projects, they fall off the table. And because these alternatives don't meet the company's needs. What does that mean? It means that the applicant is being allowed to limit the slate of alternatives in environmental review on economic basis. And how are they doing that? Reason one. The applicant has a FERC, that's Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, approved tariff rate that is calculated on going from the Bakken to Clearbrook to Superior to their hub. And they say, well, we have that rate, therefore, that's the route we have to consider. They're being allowed to use that as a justification for not allowing these other routes in environmental review. The company claims that they have unusual pipeline pressure cycling issues that crop up if they follow more circuitous routes around Minnesota's safer environment away from the lakes and streams. That's an economic argument. It's a private need, not a public need. Reason three, the applicant claims that they have approval from North Dakota up to our border where it is, so we have to start from there. We can't go any other entry point into Minnesota. That's an economic argument that the company is offering, not an environmental one. And reason four, and I was at the PUC commissioner's meeting when this discussion took place, and it was a swing vote whether to include one of the project alternatives that citizens proposed, and the commissioner stated that they would not vote for it because agencies did not have staff capacity to participate. That's wrong, but no one rose to correct the commissioner's belief on that, so the vote on that basis stood. Where does the confusion come from about excluding these alternatives? When you read EQB rules, there is specific cautionary guidance there that said alternatives may not be excluded only if they meet one or more, or they may be excluded only if they include one or more of these criteria. And I'm pointing out the first one in particular, that the underlying need for or purpose of the project is not met. You can throw alternatives off the table if they're not meeting the purpose. The problem is, how do you define the purpose? If we define it as a private industry purpose, that's one thing. If you define it as a public purpose, it's a totally different criterion. So the public need is to meet the nation and Midwest state's energy needs by transporting oil from the Bakken to distribution hubs and refineries in the Midwest. That would be the public need. But the company private need is to satisfy the contracts I mentioned before and to conform to the FERC regulations that they got rates for and then go through those connected dot points of Clearbrook and Superior. So you see how they're able to use those criteria to eliminate routes on a private need, not the public need. One of your commissioners asked a very important question, and that is about the power of eminent domain. It seems to me that if we grant the awesome power of eminent domain to a private company, that project must then serve a public good. If it's serving a public good, then it seems that the private reasons for not considering routes fall off the table. They must put the public needs higher in consideration. So the power of eminent domain is a tremendous economic advantage to the company. Can you imagine a pipeline company going out and negotiating with a whole series of landowners one by one for the price they wanted and did not have the club of eminent domain over their heads? So it is a very valuable tool that the government grants them. Don't you suppose the company owes the citizens of Minnesota in return for that granting of that power? much better consideration of their resources when they impacted them with a pipeline. By the way, that value has never been calculated, and I would like to see that done in any study. So what's the bottom line? When a private company or entity requests to use Minnesota's awesome power of eminent domain to meet a public need, it is a public project. And then when you're asking a permit from a public utility commission, it's clearly a public project. And a private entity granted this power owes the citizen of Minnesota special legal and moral deference to protect its resources. That's not only good corporate citizenship. We believe that's what the law is. So how do MEPA and EQB clarify these rules? MEPA, as you know, says that economics alone shall not justify pollution when a reasonable alternative exists. And you have a rule, and I cite it here, 4410-3100. The public project proposer may not take any action to prejudice the ultimate decision prior to a completed environmental review, yet they have FERC rates, yet they have contracts, yet they have connect-the-dot requirements that are being used to eliminate alternatives. That's not fair to citizens. What has the EQB told other RGUs? I underline here, occasionally an RGU will claim desirable but non-essential elements as a part of the project's purpose and need, and thus eliminate alternatives that should be included. Part B, these cost factors can't overrule environmental factors, but the PUC and Department of Commerce are allowing them to do that. Citizens have screamed bloody murder, and they continue to insist that that's fair game. The current status? PUC pipeline rules are a muddled, antiquated mess. They are opaque, sometimes contradictory, and preclude meaningful public participation. I can explain why all the talk of public participation is, in fact, not public participation. But now the Court of Appeals has ruled. EQB rules are straightforward, while the PUC rules are very muddled. And the Supreme Court ruled that now you're playing by the MEPA rules, not the PUC rules. We're hoping that that's going to be the case. So the question is, will they? It's also interesting to note that in an interview with the Grand Forks Herald just the day before yesterday, Mr. Evers, project director, who's in the audience here today, and I mentioned it to him that I read the article and I thought it was worthy of quoting, because the paper asked, so you're calling for a full environmental impact statement, and Mr. Evers agreed, said yes, that our opponents have called for an EIS, and we have said let's do one. Then the Herald went exactly to the question I've been talking about, and that is that some critics were saying that the pipeline shouldn't go to Superior at all. Where does that debate stand? The company has been told that all the citizen alternatives are off the table. Therefore, an EIS is welcome. No wonder. So how can EQB assure which rules prevail? The EQB can exercise extraordinary authority to change the RGU. EQB has limited authority to change the RGU that is properly designated under the rules, and EQB can change the RGU only if making the change results in the appointment of an RGU that has greater expertise in analyzing potential impacts. I would submit that PUC and Department of Commerce have demonstrated that they are not only incapable of, but they are unwilling to consider reasonable alternatives to this project by demonstration of their actions in this case. How can you assure quality review and restore public confidence? By retaining the authority for determination of final adequacy of the EIS. We're seriously going to ask you as a board to retain that authority here. Let them prepare a document, but to restore the citizen confidence in the process, because we do believe that even though an EIS has been ordered, there are a number of ways they can jigger the process, and we want you to stand by as safeguarding of MEPA and safeguarding of the citizens to make sure this is done properly. So, scope and scale of the project is enormous, and the environmental consequences are huge. Is this time for ER light? Can the Department of Commerce change their paradigm? We think not. Minnesota citizens and the environment both need help from the EQB. Do you have any questions?
Any questions for Mr. Madison?
Okay. Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Madison, for your presentation. I'm just wondering if we could get copies of the presentation.
You sure can.
Can you get those emailed to the executive director?
I will.
Commissioner Stein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Madison, you said you intend to ask the EQB. Is this your ask, or are you going to reduce your ask to some other form?
I'm glad you asked that question, because I would like to submit it in the most acceptable form possible. If you would like that as a form of a petition, I could do that. If it's sufficient coming in over my signature from my whatever position I have in standing in your eyes, I would do that as well.
Mr. Chair, I don't want to speak for the board, but I do think putting it in writing is necessary, because you've made an interpretation of law and rule that I think we need to evaluate. In order for that to be done properly, I think it would be prudent for us to see it in writing.
I'd be very happy to do that. Thank you.
Other questions? If not, Mr. Madison, thank you for your time. Thank you for your presentation.
Thank you for your patience.
Our next testifier is Kathy Hollander of Minneapolis.
I look forward to helping you with that.
Hello, my name is Kathy Hollander of Minneapolis.
Welcome, Kathy.
I have to welcome some of that humor, because I also must apply humor. I thought I was retired. Willis mentioned he's given a year and a half of his life. I've given 2.5 years of my life to understand the Public Utilities Commission, to learn as much as I can about pipelines. I've presented to many of you in this room. Many in this audience know me. I would like to talk a little bit about Courtney's presentation about economics and just add some points to it. I didn't know we were going to have a public comment period, so my comments are not formally done. I would like to mention that the cost of climate change was not included in those economic costs to pipelines, such things as floods, extreme floods, washouts, exposed pipes at streams, pipes popping out of the ground we've all seen in northern Minnesota. I've noticed myself from researching at the Office of Pipeline Safety, I've noticed that there's been kind of incidents of pipeline failures during the heat, during summers. July, for example, seems to be a great month for pipeline failures. And as climate change increases the temperature of our earth, I'm wondering about pipeline failures and heat. I also know that Mark Seeley has done great presentations, Paul Douglas, about specific impacts of climate change on Minnesota. All of those things have a cost. And to pretend that there isn't a cost isn't right. I'd also like to say the cost of carbon has a cost. These pipelines that pump the tar sands diluvite from Canada, it takes a lot more electricity to pump that sludgy stuff. Most of that electricity in northern Minnesota, as far as I understand, is coal-fired electricity. That's sort of creating a little circular cycle here where we're making a current climate change worse because we're bringing down more oil. This just doesn't make sense to me. Sorry, I'm a mother. I go back to kindergarten, things we learned. If something's not working, stop doing it. I'd also like to point out there's an excess oil on the market. I've seen pictures of tankers that are queuing up in the Gulf of Mexico. Oil storage at Cushing, Oklahoma is at an all-time high. We're running out of tankers to rent, to store oil in. We are using diesel fuel on the ocean to drive oil around because we don't have a place for it. Someone mentioned that the possibility of the crude oil export ban being lifted might help, Bakken production go back up. Where are we going to put this oil, folks? I'm just saying we're at an all-time high. I believe that with the Paris climate talks, people will start to realize and start to make specific implementations to reduce their oil consumption. I would like to mention also that Canada was one of the countries in Paris who voted for or who, brought to the table 1.5 degrees Celsius, no greater than. That's Canada, the producers of the Canadian oil sands. Also, India has, come to the table on that as well. I'd also like to point out, as far as I understand economics, if there is $5 in oil available in Saudi Arabia, and we have talked about, and on page 21 of this report, we talk about the Bakken oil has a break-even point, and we can argue what the number is. It might be 50, it might be 69. Dave Christensen gave a presentation to the Legislative Energy Commission where he said on average Bakken break-even is about 26, 27. Again, I'm going from memory here. I didn't have a chance to prepare. But if we are competing with $5 in Saudi Arabian oil, in what universe is Bakken oil going to remain viable? I'd also like to point out, what is the cost of clean water? I drink Mississippi River water. My body is about 75% or 70% unfiltered Mississippi River water. I'd like to keep that in as good shape as possible. They've pulled back in the Bakken to the three most productive counties. Once the oil gets sucked out of those counties, are we going to pretend that the production is still going to keep going up? Some analysts are saying the price of oil might be depressed for 6 to 7 years because we know that additional sources of oil are coming online. If Iran, if our restrictions on Iran are taken off, Russia's talking about producing more oil. Saudi Arabia is openly saying that they're going to keep pumping oil out because I think people are recognizing the era of oil is coming to an end. And everybody's trying to get their dollar maximization. Sorry, I'm getting some looks here like you're mad at me for talking about this. I'm just, as a mother, I'm saying if I taught kindergarten kids these facts and then I said, let's go drill for more oil, a 5 to 6 year old would know this is not making sense. There's also a huge debt load in the Bakken, debt load. The companies that are vertically integrated, say you own the wells, say you own the pipelines, say you own the refineries, the high bank companies that have a lot of money behind them, they can sustain production below their break-even point. But how long can little companies do that? What we're seeing is the little ones are being eaten up by the larger companies in the Bakken. And when debt comes to pay, when they can't make their debt payments, we're going to see a market crash unlike the housing crash, you know, unlike anything we have seen. If we keep pretending that this Bakken oil can keep coming out at a cost below their production cost. We see mines in the Canadian tar sands field being closed. And the reason I was on the phone out in the lobby this morning when a lot of people were arriving between 12 and 1, I was just listening to J. Drake Hamilton's report back from Paris. Her webinar was between 12 and 1. She reports 15,000 jobs in Minnesota due to clean energy. And she also says, at the very end of her talk, and her talk was very positive, she really believes that the countries of the world, including India and China, are starting to come to the table and realizing, you know, the actual words in the climate agreement were, we will pursue efforts to get to 1.5, no greater Celsius temperature rise than 1.5, and China and India were there. But J. Drake Hamilton says the key to all of this happening at Paris was public information and engagement to ensure that sound science policy and legal actions will take place. And you are seeing people who are activated, who are not going to give up, who believe that our grandkids' future is on the line, and we're going to stay here. I'd also like to point out that one pipeline company's in the tax court trying to reduce their property tax payments to Minnesota. I don't know why, but they apparently the property land that their pipelines run through have depreciated in value. Just kind of interesting. They're also possibly going to apply for electrical rate reduction and put the cost of electricity on ordinary rate payers because they have more than 10% of their revenue or 10% of their expenses is going to electricity. Why would they get an electric break and make ordinary people in northern Minnesota pay more? Finally, I have looked at oil by rail. This will be my last topic, Brian, then I'll be done. I've looked at oil or rail by a lot because I've heard this argument. You know, if we don't have pipelines, we're going to have more oil by rail. And I don't believe it. And I'm telling you, what I've learned is rail is faster. It's a lot more flexible. It goes to places where pipelines do not exist. It does not require storage. Let me tell you what I mean by that. But remember we talked about storage in Cushing's at an all-time high. And with oil by rail, you store that oil on those tank cars until it gets to the refinery or wherever it goes. Right now with the Connect the Dots little game we were playing with Wilson, oil often is stored in Clearbrook, Minnesota, on its way to somewhere. Then it gets stored in Superior, Wisconsin, in storage tanks. By the way, it also gets mixed with other oils there. Then it gets stored in Chicago. Then it goes down to Cushing and gets stored there. All of that storage is running out. So when you put it on oil by rail, you can get it from point A to point B without going through intermediary storage tanks, which is an advantage. Oil by rail has shorter contracts. The purity of oil is maintained. I'll note our Northern Tier refinery right here in, where is it, Rosemont? Mentioned that there's a couple of wells, really sweet wells, that they like in the Bakken, and they found that those specific wells produced oil that really works well for their refinery. So how are they going to get it to their refinery? Are they going to put it on a pipeline and have it be contaminated? No, they're talking about rail or trucks to get that kind of oil to their refinery. Purity of oil is maintained in rail cars. Also, Willis mentioned FERC reports a little bit. To ship oil by pipelines, you have to go through a ton of hoops. I've read the FERC reports. There's a page and a half of requirements that the oil shippers have to go through in order to ship oil by pipeline. And that's not the case with rail. You know, you can kind of have a much shorter contract and you can ship it. Also, finally, my last arrow I'd like to throw is that there's other commodities that are going by rail that have been reduced in quantity as we close down coal-fired plants. You know, the amount of coal that's being shipped by rail is going down. Also, unfortunately, iron ore pellets, due to the economic depression in the northeastern Minnesota area, those shipments are down. And if unusual weather is producing problems in drying of agricultural products like happened in that one winter, again, I say, with climate change, unusual weather is going to happen more. So, this is just circular. We're doing things to mitigate climate change effects, and we're causing more climate change by pulling more oil out of Canada. And lastly, I'd like to say, why is it a need that we have to take oil from Canada or the Bakken because they want to produce more? Why is that a need for us in Minnesota? Somebody's making a lot of money on it, I understand that, but does that create a need for us? So with that, I bid you adieu and thank you for listening. It's been great fun.
Thank you, Kathy. For not coming prepared, you were pretty prepared.
I just winged it.
Our next speaker is Richard Smith from Park Rapids. Yeah, I think so. I think we had 10 total. I know the first two, but I think it's going to start with this game. Let's see. And we've got enough speakers. I am going to respect all speakers. I know they all want to address the board. So, and it's imperative that we get all the speakers on the videotape and out to the webcast. So I'm going to need to start sticking closer to that 5-minute time limit. Our next speaker after this gentleman will be Tom Watson from Pine River. If Mr. Watson would prepare himself.
Well, you've gotten lucky. And I've gotten unlucky. My name is Richard Smith. I am president of Friends of the Headwaters, Chairman Napstead, commissioners, and board members of the EQB. I want to thank you for providing this opportunity. Unfortunately, I'm a professional photographer, and I was hoping to show you a few pretty pictures and a big pile of maps. And apparently, although my PDF was working just fine at home this morning, it appears not to be working at all right now. So I am going to be at a little bit of a loss here, but I have passed out some homework to all of you. One is, and I think what I will do is dovetail off of Mr. Mattson and Kathy Hollander. Obviously, we are the group, with the help of counsel from the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy and also our friends at the Carlton County Land Stewards, we are the group that brought the court case against the PUC. My presentation was going to be why we brought that court case against the PUC, and I think actually, given that 2 years have essentially transpired since we started all of this, I think now more than ever, as the court ruled, they ruled that a comprehensive EIS is necessary before producing a certificate of need. A lot of things have changed dramatically in the world since the company first filed their application for the certificate of need. Obviously, a lot of new things were learned in Paris a couple weeks ago. Last week, the National Academy of Sciences produced their report on Dilbit or tar sands. It was a very negative report towards transporting tar sands oil through water environments, of which we are primarily. Yesterday, our Congress ruled that it's okay now to export crude oil. The first company to step in line to apply for a permit to export crude oil, the company that wants to put the pipeline through Minnesota. Both of these projects combined, Sandpiper and the Line 3 rebuild, are 300,000 barrels per day more oil through our state than the Keystone XL project, which was recently vetoed by President Obama. The reason we brought in EIS is when we looked at the resource maps of this state, and you have the maps before you so you can look at them at your leisure, is we thought it was impossible to push a pipeline through the middle of what is the most important natural resource in our state. You know, we are the land of 10,000 lakes. Every map we looked at, whether it was where clear and clean lakes are, what that means for property values, where are most susceptible soils to groundwater contamination are, that happens to be at the bottom of my county where I live. I live about 15 miles from Itasca State Park. Where our primary wetlands are, what our wetlands mean in terms of our only native grain in this state, wild rice. The pipeline runs through the heart of our best wild rice country. I mean, who could pick a worse route? Not only for what we consider our in a kind of our identity, but which is also critically important to our Ojibwe friends and neighbors here. When you look at other maps, when you look at where the best lakes are left in the state, this corridor runs through it. When you look at the lakes that are still redeemable in this state and can still be protected, their corridor runs right through it. When you look at where the most water courses are in this state, their corridor runs right through it. Their corridor also runs right next to the second oldest state park in the United States, Itasca. The headwaters of the Mississippi is a culturally, spiritually, geographically, an incredibly significant spot. It's a spot that all of us as Minnesotans are very proud to know and be near and have the opportunity to walk across, whether we're children or not. The decisions that the PUC and the Department of Commerce, EERA, have made at this point have put a bullseye right on our national treasure here at Itasca State Park. When we look at all of those factors, we think that the only way to deal with this proposed new energy corridor across the state of Minnesota is to do a full and comprehensive EIS, not a quote-unquote MEPA statute CEA, but a full and comprehensive EIS that not only looks at the company's proposed route, but also looks at other portions of the state as to what may be if we have to be a pass-through state and if we have to have pipeline corridors going through our state, where is the safest location to pass through the state? Willis showed you a map with some of our suggested system alternatives. A year ago summer, some of the staff at our Pollution Control Agency looked at those alternatives and rated them environmentally against the company's proposed route. One of our routes, SA04, which is an entire, that route is a complete and existing pipeline corridor right now. It does not require any new greenland to be disturbed. Rated the best environmentally for the state. The worst was the pipeline, was the Enbridge's proposed pipeline corridor. That's why we think an EIS needs to be done. What the court has ruled, the court's given you a great gift. You can be leaders in upholding an EIS and upholding and restoring the MEPA law as it should be conducted in this state. I don't know why the oil industry is the only industry in this state that gets a pass on doing a full EIS. As Willis mentioned, the state has never done a full EIS on a pipeline here. So I think I'm done because I don't have any nice pictures to show you.
Well, you've provided us some nice pictures.
But I just want to say one thing, besides speaking for a great number of concerned citizens up in my neck of the woods, but also around the whole state and outside of this country, by the way, we have supporters. I'm also the voice for our critters in this state. I want you to consider all of that in your deliberations regarding this. You need to be the discretionary authority and to exercise the proper functions of the MEPA law in this state. The other issue that I have that's of great concern to us is, and as Commissioner Stein brought up, we don't believe that the Department of Commerce should be the sole authority in executing any kind of EIS here. We believe that that needs to be in an entirely joint management between the PCA and the DNR. Preferably, we'd like the PCA and the DNR to be a lead on that because they're the two agencies responsible in our state for the environment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith.
I want to invite Richard to help testify on our PolyMed EIS. I'm delighted to hear that people have great confidence in PCA and DNR in development of EIS. So thank you, Richard. Appreciate it.
Doesn't sound like that. It's that way when you're there, does it?
Nice try, Tom.
Welcome, Mr. Watson. Could you please introduce yourself for the record?
My name is Tom Watson. I live at 39195 Swanberg Court in the greater part of Minnesota called North Crow Wing County. You can't even find it on a Google map, but it's there. For the record, I have served in public office. I spent 7 terms here in the metropolitan area as elected official, 4 terms as a mayor. And I currently represent as president of the Whitefish Area Property Owners Association, which is a 501c3 organization representing about 1,200 members, 100 of whom are business owners in the area, and about 1,100 family and individual members that support us. As to an array of activities that we're involved in, we do an awful lot of water quality testing in conjunction with the MPCA. In other words, we send our data on to them. We do a lot of work with the DNR on water quality. We just finished a lake trout study with Tom's folks over in Park Rapids, which was wonderful. And so we're a pretty active organization. We are the largest nonprofit lake association in Minnesota. The Whitefish Chain of Lakes, by the record, if I can get the commissioner to finally get his website correct, we're the 9th largest contiguous public body of water in Minnesota. We're actually, Tom, we're actually 40 acres larger than Minnetonka. I'll work on that with you. Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you. It was brought to my attention that you were considering this matter last night, I think about 9:15, and so I had an opportunity to scan through your report. I didn't get a chance to read it very carefully, but that second glass of wine helped get through it. The couple things that I really want to address, and there's a handout that's a single-page, two-sided document for you. We invited Enbridge to a work session of our board in public a little over a year ago in August, or September, I guess it was, and have had meaningful discussions with them. And one of the things that came out of that that puzzled me at the time was that the proposal that's also contained in this report that's got a heavy emphasis on what the economics of the oil industry and oil transportation, et cetera, is. What's not in that report and what's not ever really talked about, and I have done quite a bit of research. I'm not at 2.5 years like some of the others. I'm only at about 100 hours. But I started taking a look at what's the economy that's related to quality waters we have in Minnesota. We're fortunate to be in a state not only with more than 10,000 lakes, but we have 10,000 good quality lakes, certainly in the northern half of the state. And so as I took a look at that, what I have in that document in front of you is to just simply point out that the economy of Minnesota is heavily, heavily dependent on travel, tourism, hospitality, leisure. It's the largest industry in north central Minnesota. It exceeds manufacturing, it exceeds timber production, it exceeds anything. If you look at property values, you look at economic value of properties for tax purposes in those counties, et cetera, it's enormous. 40% of the tax, just as an example, 40% of the tax paid in Crow Wing County property taxes to the county comes from six communities right around the Whitefish chain, which we represent 25% of the property values, pay 40% of the tax. Something wrong with that. But it tells you an important factor in that, and that is it is attraction for people to come to that area and set up businesses, set up second homes, have leisure properties, do retire in the community and otherwise. As the report says, and I referenced the first table, travel expenditures in 2007-2008. Now, let me qualify why that data is 2007-2008. It's done through the University of Minnesota. They don't do that research every year. They contract to have this done about every 10 years. And 2007-2008 was a fairly heavily recessionary period, or at least we were certainly still in it. Travel expenditures, and that's defined as somebody whose domicile was more than 50 miles from the border of Crow Wing County, was $300,000 in that year, or $300 million, I should say, correct myself. And state revenue, that's sales tax and income tax on the businesses in that area, was $135 million, and it generated 7,200 jobs. So then I started saying, all right, let's take a look at this whole corridor that's being proposed from Hubbard County, Park Rapids, on through Aiken County. And you'll see that that represents nearly $750 million a year of revenue. It represents almost a third of $1 billion of state tax revenue, and it's 1,700 jobs. Enbridge has talked about the fact that they are going to produce a certain amount of revenue at $100 million, whatever. That's pale compared to these numbers. It's not significant, insignificant. Let's take it. But let's figure out where that's going to go. They've talked about 1,500 construction jobs. They've recently talked about 25 to 30 permanent jobs would be in the area after construction. I'm talking about 1,700 jobs that already exist in the area that I think we have to take into consideration. What is the consequence if we do something wrong, if we have some spills, we have some other breaches, as we call it? What's that negative impact? And in these reports, we ought to be taking a look at what values we have already and look at the consequences both for and against any kind of impacts. In other words, what can we do to expend it, extend it, and expand on it? What are some of the negative consequences if we do something wrong? My comment, which was in the Star Tribune, this is an opportunity to get it right. This is not an opportunity to get it done. It's an opportunity to get it right. The test of all of this, Richard Smith will find this recall. I had Richard make a presentation to a group of property owners from outing and along that corridor back this summer. And after we were done, we went back and sat in the corner of my dock and enjoyed a beverage. Sounds like something I do all the time. It's enjoyable in the summer. Thank you, Mr. Landwehr. My daughter and granddaughter were there. My granddaughter is three. Richard said to her, "Why do you enjoy coming to the lake? Why do you enjoy coming to Grandpa's lake?" And she said, "Clean water, quality water." 3 years old. Now, I didn't prepare her, but I suspect going to the lake is more than just a Minnesota passive term, going up north, those kinds of things. It's reflected in this data that it's extremely significant, and we need to get this factored into all of our work and all of our reviews in these reports that are coming out. Let me go down the page a little bit further. In 2013, this is strictly with respect to travel and leisure. This comes out of the tourism department of the state. In 2013, I since have now some 14 data. It's very much the same. You can see what those numbers are. $333 billion is spent on travel and leisure. Now, that's not second homeowners. That's not people buying cars and transacting business. These are people recreating and simply vacationing in the area, whatever. It's a significant piece of work. Let me leave you with the last concept. In my public life in the Twin Cities, we were dealing with urban deer a lot. And one of the questions we always talked about was, how many urban deer can you have in a particular area to keep them healthy, to not overrun the place? They'll still eat your hostas, but, you know, how many keep them healthy and fat so they can survive the winter and those kinds of things? And I learned from folks at the DNR a concept called the biological carrying capacity of an area. I'm suggesting we should now start to apply that to water. Our lakes are becoming a very, very popular thing, and consequently they're becoming overused. We've got non-native invasive species all over our area. It's not coming in many cases by our residents. It's being transported from elsewhere in lots of cases. We've got better motors. We've got higher motors. We've got all kinds of things that are impacting the water. Now we're going to talk about putting pipelines and construction and more erosion. And as Tom can probably tell you, that the work we're doing with some of his staff in Brainerd is looking upstream at miles and acres away from shorelines and looking at how to protect the quality of water at the shoreline. What are we doing with conservation easements 2 and 3 and 4 miles away from those shorelines as a way of managing stormwater and runoff and those kinds of matters? This is the area that Enbridge wants to run a pipeline through that. I'm not arguing, and we have never as an organization gotten into the debate about whether pipelines are needed, whether they're better than rail cars, etc. I was just in Benson, Minnesota, so I understand what that's all about. What I'm saying is routing is the critical issue for all of us. If we get it wrong, we're going to pay the price. And we're going to pay for it permanently. It's going to happen to our ancestors, I mean, to our successors and to our offspring and those kinds of things. It isn't going to benefit me in my lifetime. I'm 71 years old. But I give a damn about what happens, and it's time we get this right. And I'd like to see your agencies, because I know that the commissioner from Economic Development is part of the EQB. It's important that there be a chapter in that economic session that looks at the very data that I'm talking about in here, and not just strictly looking at the economics as would be written by the petroleum industry. Thank you. Questions?
Any questions for Mr. Watson?
Thank you.
If not, thank you. Thank you.
I got my mentoring from Tom Landwehr when he was a city council member.
The next person who wishes to testify is Eileen Shore of Minneapolis. The clock is going down faster than our piles of people who want to talk, so please watch your time.
Mr. Chairman and members of the board, thank you. I have tried to cut back, so we're going to go. My name is Eileen Shore. I live in Minneapolis. I'm a retired environmental lawyer. I began my legal career with Montana's Environmental Quality Board. While in law school on the East Coast, I worked at the Environmental Law Reporter. I worked there included tracking many of the early lawsuits that were prompted by the implementation of the National Environmental Policy Act. I then spent 8 years as the chief legal counsel to the Montana Public Utilities Commission. Given that background, I think that the Environmental Quality Board here can make a creative and important leadership contribution to progress in this area that has been too long delayed. But it is also possible that we will continue with business as usual, as the pipeline companies and the environmental unit of the Commerce Department have been urging throughout this process. Business as usual has been a kind of quick and shallow review that simply should not do for a state that has prided itself on progressive environmental policies. I think it's important to emphasize that Friends of the Headwaters never has taken a no pipeline position. It has been consistent from its beginnings in saying that the potential impacts must be competently evaluated. The state must take a very hard look at whether the company's proposed route is the right one. A route, by the way, which was first established before any modern environmental policy or law was in effect. These organizations have persistently challenged the assumption which is embedded in the current process that this route is in fact the best one for new pipelines, which will be in the ground for 50 to 100 years. both the Friends of the Headwaters and other groups who have been making presentations to the Public Utilities Commission have asked, can't we do it any better than this? FOH, as you know, developed a number of alternative routes, and they have received favorable comments from many. Ansel Adams said, it is horrifying when we have to fight our own government to save the environment, and yet I have to say personally, at times during this process, although I am familiar with it, it has felt like that is what we have been doing. This may be the only chance for Minnesota to take a good, in-depth, scientifically based look at the potential environmental impacts of pipelines that will carry more oil than Keystone XL. If that opportunity passes, I think there is a real question about what EQB does to contribute to this state's environmental policy. As you have heard, we have never had an EIS for an oil pipeline passing through this state. If not now, when? As Bill Grant outlined, as we all know, the comparative environmental analysis process was approved in 1989 as an alternative EIS equivalent. That is what we call a legal fiction. It is not true, in other words. CEAs have not been and can never be equivalent to an EIS. There are many essential foundational deficiencies, including shallowness, preparation time, objectivity of information, use of independent information sources, lack of agency expertise, and lack of meaningful public participation. I would challenge EQB or anyone else to find an objective, unbiased expert in environmental review who would tell you that Minnesota has done an adequate job of environmental analysis for pipelines through its use of the CEA process. Because of this failure, groups like FOH and others have had to do what the state is supposed to do, provide competent, independent environmental analysis about these gigantic projects. Because of reliance on this legal fiction, pipeline companies have built pipelines exactly where they want to build them, exactly when they wanted to build them. Now, thanks to these small groups, this board and the state of Minnesota has the opportunity to reclaim what has been lost since 1989. In comments filed on October 30th, Commissioner Rothman did recommend that a three-agency EIS be prepared, and Enbridge agreed that an EIS should go forward. So why are we still concerned? Why are we taking up your time and forcing you to do five-minute limits on your public? My answer is that 2 weeks after those recommendations for an EIS were filed by Commissioner Rothman, the Commerce Department's Environmental Unit filed a scoping report as a preliminary step for the preparation of a CEA. At first, it seemed like a very odd thing to do, given subsequent events like the Court of Appeals decision and Commissioner Rothman's recommendation. And then when we read the report, it became clear. The Commerce staff claimed that this report, begun as a preliminary to a CEA, would actually do just fine for an EIS. An EIS, it projected, would be completed by spring of next year. This is simply the latest course of conduct that we have seen throughout this process from the Commerce Department's Environmental Unit, supported by pipeline companies. Now they are aggressively advocating that the old express lane CEA approach should be used for the EIS that Commissioner Rothman recommended. It now appears, based on the filing, that the Commerce Environmental Unit wants to use a scoping process that does not meet EQB requirements in a number of respects as a foundation document for an EIS. This will not do. In other words, without firm leadership from the EQB and from the environmental agencies, we will have business as usual, whatever we call it. CEAs, which have never provided adequate public participation, CEAs which have never reflected anything but company-generated information, CEAs which have never gone through a draft and a final version, CEAs that have never come close to EQB guidance for EISs. I brought with me today, I'm close, copies of the Court of Appeals decision in the Sandpiper case. Since the staff informed me that there was no intent that it be part of today's meeting, to be honest, I found that pretty shocking, that a meeting devoted entirely to pipelines and their environmental review was not going to include this document. Because with the Supreme Court's action yesterday, now that is a final and binding decision interpreting MEPA as it relates to pipeline requests. I hope you all have a chance to read the decision if you have not already. It is pretty short. I think it's clear and persuasive. I think it suggests the kind of public policy that EQB is in a position to support and advance. It is well written and wonderfully free of legalistic jargon. We ask for your help. This small, motley group of passionately committed people have done some remarkable work, even without much help from their government. Think of what they can do if the agencies, EQB, PCA, DNR, enter wholeheartedly into taking a hard look, a scientifically grounded examination of potential environmental consequences of projects proposed by those who want to use the state's lands and waters and powers of eminent domain and government authorizations to advance their work and their profits. We ask that you enter into that work and to help us and the companies find the best solution for the citizens of this state. Thank you.
Thank you, Eileen. Any questions? If not, we will move on to Andy Pearson of Minneapolis.
Hello, and thank you very much. I will keep my comments quick today. My name is Andy Pearson. I'm from Minneapolis. So I want to talk for a minute about economic impacts, and particularly economic impacts of climate change. It's already been brought up, but that was one of the most stunning things for me in reading this report, was seeing climate not touched on in the economic impact section. That section read more or less like an Enbridge pamphlet. The rest of the report had a lot of good climate discussion in it, but economic impact seemed to focus much more on the positive. So I wanted to talk about a few things. It's been brought up, the potential hit to the tourism economy, that $13 billion economy. That's a lot of how we identify ourselves in Minnesota, as a place where you can go up north and the water is pure and you can spend your time up there. It's such a part of our own culture here. So no discussion of how that set of economics that are tied into the tourism could be affected by either pipeline construction or, heaven forbid, a pipeline spill. And we know that the pipelines do spill. I want to go back to page 48 of the report. The word may perpetuate a carbon-based economic structure. That pipeline construction may perpetuate. So I'm all for ambiguity when ambiguity is called for, but in this case, I think building a $2.6 billion investment that's designed explicitly to perpetuate a carbon-based economic structure is probably a will and not a may. Let's cut out the ambiguity where we can and be clear about what we're actually doing here. Now, we've also heard, you know, wonderful comments by board member Knuth about her time in Paris recently, and I think we're seeing the world community come together around the need to keep fossil fuels in the ground and stop making these huge investments in what's an outdated system of energy. Very recently, this same Environmental Quality Board put out a wonderful report. That wonderful report, Minnesota and Climate Change, Our Tomorrow Starts Today. So I want to pull out one piece from that report. Again, back to economics. That report by this same board says that Minnesota suffers $1.2 billion in annual damages to the state just from the climate impacts connected to the electricity generation that powers Minnesota. That's not even including $800 million in acute health impact, say from the air pollution from coal plants. That's only the impacts from a warming and climate destabilized state. That's $1.2 billion currently. That's not projected. That's per year, all right? Why would we do something that's likely to increase those impacts on us, especially when the total investment in this pipeline, including construction impacts, is only about 2 years of the climate damages that we see? Let's talk for just a minute about news and what's coming out of the Bakken. Had some good discussion earlier around the projected output from the Bakken and that falling off. But I want to, you know, note that we may see a sharper fall off than has been projected earlier, because while these companies are still extracting, they're extracting for the most part at a loss. I'm not exaggerating when I say the most part. I refer to a November 3rd article by Art Berman, who's a petroleum geologist for 37 years and now writes for Forbes. So this is somebody who knows what he's talking about. He wrote a piece that only 1% of the Bakken play breaks even at current oil prices. That's 1% breaking even. October 24th, Wall Street Journal published a headline, Occidental Petroleum Exits Bakken Shale Amid Heavy Losses, and cited a $2.61 billion loss. So these are plays that are not going to be economical to continue to invest in right now in our current oil economy. My last thing that I want to note is that in the presentation of the report, which I enjoyed, I only heard a little bit of laughter a few times, and I love laughter. I love being happy. I think we should all try to laugh as much as we can. But there were two moments when it felt to me like I should bring it up here, and so I'm going to. There was some laughter around the idea that some more climate study was needed, and also that more public involvement was needed. And there was only about laughter four times during the presentation. So I'm bringing that up not to call it out and say that we shouldn't laugh, but to say that that I think for a lot of the folks in this room who are almost all volunteers who are here, you know, on their own time, it's not funny to us. And the perception that it's funny to some folks in this room, you know, that I could be spending this day in Golden Valley with my family. It's almost Christmas. I'd really like to be there, you know, and I'm here. And I know a lot of us have similar stories there. This is not a laughing matter. It's not funny to us. So please keep that in mind. Going back to that climate change report, the subtitle, Our Tomorrow Starts Today. Let's make it start today. Let's make the right choices here. Thank you. Any questions?
Questions? If not, thank you.
Thank you.
The next person to testify is John Swanson from Duluth, Minnesota.
Good afternoon, Chairman and Board members.
Welcome.
My name is John Swanson. I work for Enbridge Energy in the role of Vice President in charge of U.S. major projects, particularly in the upper Midwest here. On behalf of myself and Enbridge, I want to thank you for the opportunity to comment on the report. That's what we're here today, to comment on the report. Thank you to the members of the interagency panel for their efforts. Many of the suggested revisions were included in the final version, and we appreciate that. It is our hope that the report will spark additional conversations between the agencies and the industry, resulting in a better understanding of how pipelines are constructed and operating safely. And we feel the report does a good first step in terms of educating the public and informing them. They're an important component of Minnesota's energy infrastructure. Because the report is intended to portray Minnesota's current relationship with its crude petroleum and its transportation, I think it's important to note a few items. First, Minnesota produces no crude petroleum. Its refineries receive 80% of the crude they refine from Enbridge's pipeline system. Pipelines are widely accepted as the safest and most efficient means of transporting petroleum liquids, requiring significantly less energy than trucks or rail, and have a much lower carbon footprint. Transporting crude oil safely is a shared objective, as evidenced by this report. It's our responsibility as an operator to operate safely, but it's regulatory obligation to make sure that we do so, and we appreciate that. Our first priority is safety. We try to maintain the highest standards and best practices to protect our employees, protect residents, protect natural resources, and protect the general public. Enbridge is making significant investments in pipeline projects that we think will reduce rail congestion, provide good-paying jobs needed right now in Minnesota, and provide substantial tax revenue at the county level. The capital we're investing in our pipeline systems is critical to ensuring the energy supply reaches those who need it. As a company that has constructed and operating pipelines in Minnesota for 65 years, we look forward to continuing to work with the EQB and state agencies on important energy infrastructure benefiting Minnesota. the region as well, and our national security. Again, we thank the EQB and state for their work on the report. While we don't agree with everything in the report, we don't disagree with everything. And once again, we think it's very important that, you take the initiative you have to get the word out there to educate people. Thank you for your comment.
Thank you, Mr. Watson. Any questions? No, thank you. Our next testifier, Craig Searle. I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Stirl.
From Stirl?
I'll
from,
pass, thank you.
Oh, okay. We'll move on then to Betty Teasel, Minneapolis. I hope I pronounced that correctly.
My name's Betty Teasel. It's a good old Slovenian name from the Iron Range. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, board members, commissioners, and staff. My name is Betty Teasel. I live in Minneapolis. Thank you for your work on the pipelines report and for providing time for public comment. Really appreciate it. Minnesota must participate in global efforts to halt and reverse overall rise in temperatures and the protection of water quality. We are not going to secure our future health and prosperity by doing things the same way we've done them for decades. I had a little chance to review the report. I only heard that there was going to be a comment allowed last night, but here's a couple things, and it's less than a page. It's longer than a haiku, and it's less than a treatise. So. Furthering oil and pipelines industries does not help Minnesotans transition to a future that relies less on fossil fuels. And this is something from the report. Supporting pipelines in order to possibly free up the railways to transport sand for hydraulic fracturing. To me, that's like robbing Peter in order to rob Paul's grandchildren. The current 111-page interagency report does not address tribal and treaty rights concerns or anything about potential fouling of waters used to grow wild rice. There is one mention of treaty rights in the public comments summary only. I would like to see those concerns studied as soon as possible. Also, I noticed that tribal regulations were not included in Mr. Grant's slide listing factors considered in route selection. It is really important to name and include tribal regulations. Sometimes I feel like I would like to apply for a certificate of need to prevent further temperature increases. I would like to apply for a certificate of need for clean water in Minnesota in perpetuity. I'm here today because I'm worried about climate change and clean water, soil, and air in Minnesota and beyond. We can't build a wall tall enough around this state. Pipelines might not keep oil in our state, but passing through doesn't mean it wouldn't impact us. So please don't let this current report be the end of your efforts to question and examine plans for pipelines and other fossil fuel development or transport in Minnesota. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your comments. Any questions? If not, next speaker is Frank Bibeau of Deer River.
Good afternoon, and thank you. Just for a point of clarification, when I said address, I put Deer River on there. I live in Ball Club, and Ball Club is really the center of the universe for the Anishinaabe people, the on Leech Lake Reservation.
Could we get your name and address for the record, please?
Sure. Frank Bibeau. Last name is B-I-B-E-A-U. And the address was on the card. It says Deer River, Minnesota, 56636. But, again, it is in Ball Club. And it's on Leech Lake Reservation, and I'm enrolled at the White Earth Reservation, so I'm very clear on what's going on around here. I've been representing Honor the Earth at the PUC. It's been a very difficult 2 years to figure out just how this process works. And the process doesn't work. It's not designed to work. It's not designed to protect the environment, really, in any meaningful way that you can figure out what's going on while it's occurring. That's why we asked to have it bifurcated, because we couldn't even understand how you could offer someone a route if you really don't even know if it's needed or necessary. It's a really odd thing to see them run parallel. Now, your process, the report that was done, is about 4 or 5 years late, but it looks good today because a lot of it's been missing. And I think a lot of the report picks up from what's been going on for the last 2 years with Sandpiper and part of Line 3. Now, part of what makes us nervous, and I'm hoping it was just a misstatement, but there was a suggestion about Phase 2 with Sandpiper, and I believe that was a misstatement, and it was meant to be maybe Phase 2 with Line 4 for the third pipeline that was being asked about, because there are, in fact, three pipeline projects, plus the one that was just crossing the border. So there's really four pipeline projects that have been going on in Minnesota over the last couple of years. And so none of that is being looked at in a combined way. And so up north, that's very concerning for us. And for me, living in Ball Club, we have eight pipelines that go along Highway 2 on the mainline corridor. So when you're talking about what's being characterized as a replacement pipeline for Line 3, you're talking about pipeline abandonment within a half mile of my house. And we're talking about hundreds of miles of pipeline. And if we do that, we're doing that for free at this point. There's no cleanup costs. There's just simply a new corridor given along with Sandpiper, which makes no sense. And that's going to develop into a larger energy corridor going through the same kind of wild rice that's being gone through now. Now, while we don't like new pipelines and things like that, we also understand what's going on in 2015. But we do believe that if Line 3 is not removed and replaced, it will probably never be removed and replaced. And we will only be putting new pipelines in, and we will be at another problem like we're looking at in Ball Club right now. 50 years from now in Park Rapids and at the headwaters of the Mississippi and everywhere across from there. You have to get in front of this problem, not a year in front of the problem. We tried that a year ago. We've been trying to get an EIS for the time period that it could have been done in already, because people don't want the EIS standard. They didn't want the no-build alternative considered. If these aren't part of the process, then our rights as citizens aren't being protected. And that's why the tribal entities are going outside the state process. We've tried to participate. White Earth has been in for a long time. Both White Earth and Leech Lake have sent petitions to the federal government to protect us and to get federal EIS going, because we do not believe it is actually going to occur here in Minnesota. There's been nothing that suggests that. We don't have confidence. We can't have confidence. Even when there's good detailed information submitted by the PCA or DNR, the PUC was just disregarding it. Now we're at a point where we watch the politics on TV and people want to make deals for unemployment. Let the Sandpiper go through. Let PolyMet go through. These are not deals that we're included in or considered in. That is completely wrong. And so we're going to end up finding out that all of these efforts have been improperly done and maybe unlawfully done in terms of the tribal rights. And it's unfortunate that the words and dialogue that should occur and be meaningful isn't happening in that fashion. And when you have to have the citizens pool their money to sue the state and the state to resist, it's hard to understand who you can rely on. But for us, we don't think it's within state government at this point. And so you're going to see us looking more and more for federal intervention, because we can't be certain of what's happening. And that's after 2 years. So I myself, as an attorney, you know, I can't explain how all this stuff happens. People have asked me, how can the agency go on with its comparative environmental assessment when the Court of Appeals says, no, you got to do an EIS? I mean, I understand from law school how you can do it, but it doesn't make sense that any citizen or person could do it We have to do a process that makes sense above board, and it's transparent and predictable. We don't have any of that. The only prediction we have from everybody out in the outstate thinks this pipeline's a done deal and it's going to go through. And that has us concerned because that is what it looks like, and the protections aren't being used or even considered. And so we do want your help, but we can't just ask for it and rely on it. And so I want you to know that we are asking other people that we think may give us that help, but we would prefer to see it here locally. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you.
I'm sorry.
I did have a question, actually. Thank you, Mr. Chair, because this issue hasn't, there's a couple issues that I think Mr. Bebo brought up that I think are important. I mean, I know this is a final report, and so this is delayed, but I, as a board member, would be interested in better understanding the relationship with tribal rights and law and Minnesota state law and how that interacts with pipelines, because I think it's a really important issue, and it's something we as a board should know more about. So that's more of a statement. Thank you for bringing that up. And then the question I also have, and maybe it's a staff question too, is this question about abandonment. And if it is a pipeline replacement, what does happen to the old pipeline and who pays for that? And, you know, I spent a lot of time thinking about, you know, the fund as a legislator, thinking about the funds for how we get gas station tankers cleaned up with the, you know, the 2 cent or whatever gas tax. That's a lot smaller than a pipeline. And so I would like to also have more information about that, if we could get that. Not right immediately, but from staff. I think that would be helpful for the board.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bebo. We do have the last four cards I have in my hand are actually individuals that submitted their comments on the back of the card and did not wish to testify before the board. We do have a few minutes before our video teleconferencing expires and this meeting adjourns. Is there anybody remaining in the audience that wishes to testify before the EQB? Anybody that wishes to make comment? Yes, sir. I don't know who he is.
Hi, my name is Craig Sturley, and I had passed earlier. I just have a question, and I wasn't aware until Richard mentioned it that Congress had passed a law saying that we could now export oil. And it brings me back to the comments that Willis was talking about in the use of eminent domain. If this oil is no longer staying in the country, why are we giving them eminent domain? I mean, it doesn't seem like it's a public benefit to us at that point. Just something to talk about.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not certain, but I think what happened yesterday is the House passed a spending bill with that provision in there. I don't believe that the Senate has passed that yet, and it certainly hasn't gone by the president yet. So the export ban has not completely been lifted yet.
Any other people wishing to comment? Kate?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I didn't see you.
Oh, I just leaned over. If you could, if there's written comments, I'm not sure how those will be transmitted to the board, so I would like, I just want to know how the four written comments will be transmitted to the full board so we can see those. And then if you want to read them on the record, that could,
read them into the record at this point in time, I can.
And then one other question, just a process thing. With the first testifier, I think Mr. Madison will be submitting some sort of written thing asking for the EQB to change the RGU to the EQB. I haven't totally understood what that is, and I'm sure there's other people who know how these processes work. If that could either be communicated now or to the board after this meeting, that would be helpful.
Thank you. The four comments are fairly brief. First is, I believe it's Kathy Koch of Minneapolis. Given the outcome of COP21, why are we even considering increasing pipeline construction and development? how will we meet our obligation if we keep extracting, especially for sand oil? Kind of got broken off at the end. Actually, this is Kathy Koch as well. How do you justify violating treaty rights? It's unlawful. This is Stan, I believe it's either Sattinger or Sittinger of Minneapolis. How can EQB justify issuing this report showing a steadily increasing projection of Bakken oil production when this projection does not reflect either current trends or the mandate for reduction coming out of COP21? And the final is Mayar Soru, M-A-H-Y-A-R-S-O-R-O-U, I believe it is spelled, St. Paul, Minnesota. These proposal pipeline projects, Sandpiper and Line 3 in parentheses, are completely disrespectful of Native treaty rights. There must be a full consultation with Native leaders to discuss alternatives before any pipeline project moves forward. It is their land, not ours. Those constitute the comments of the individuals that wish to provide written testimony rather than speak. Are there any other individuals that would like to speak? We are now at the end of our agenda as developed. Oh, I'm sorry. Commissioner Stein, did you want to make a comment?
Just wanted to respond. I feel like I left Mr. Madison kind of hanging, and I don't want that to be the case. I do want him to consult with the executive director about his making his request in the right form and addressing the right issues with the right information so that the board has full opportunity to hear the request and not have it be subject to dismissal because of improper format. So relative to that, this board is its duty is to the people, and I want to make sure you put your ask in the proper form and in the correct time and all those things so that there isn't any kind of a reason for the board to not be able to respond to it. So that, Mr. Chair, was just, I felt like I kind of said, please make your request in writing, and then I just sent you away. And I, on record, I just want to make clear that we want that request to be something that we can answer directly.
Thank you. And I assume the executive director will work with Mr. Madison to make that happen.
Yes. On the record, I knew exactly what the commissioner was saying when he first said it. Yeah, we'll work with him.
Okay. Anything else for the good of the board?
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering, where does EQB turn for additional information on treaty right issues? Where do we turn for that?
Well, I won't speak for our attorney. There have been seminars. I know, being a county commissioner, there have been seminars that discuss treaty rights, although I wouldn't say as comprehensive as an attorney may comprehend them in this context. I wonder if perhaps members of our audience might be able to direct in the right area, to the right area.
Yeah, there are resources in the state that we'll turn to, and we'll report back.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. That's what I needed to know.
Anything else? Is there a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Second.
Moved by Commissioner Stein, seconded by Commissioner Ellinger. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
We're adjourned. Thank you, everybody, for your comments and your preparation.